good evening to Europe, good morning to Asia, and good afternoon to those all across the fruited plains. You're now locked into the worldwide 20 megabit beacon of truth, hope, and justice, otherwise known as your weekly dose of the Crimson Pill. I, your host, the great and all-powerful Antonin Fiori, just make sure you don't peek behind the curtain, folks, encourage you to unfasten your seatbelts and turn on all portable electronic devices as we embark on the next voyage of the USS Crimson Pill. Our course has been charted for the Isle of Light by way of the Straits of Knowledge and the Sea of Tranquility. In the event of turbulence, the captain reminds you that your seat cushion is no substitute for an open mind. If you're seated in an exit row, you are now invited to move forward to our first-class cabin of truth at any time. Ladies and gentlemen of the listening audience, welcome to the Crimson Pill.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Crimson Pill, ladies and gentlemen, an unexpectedly early edition of the Crimson Pill. We've moved to a three-hour format today, and so we've begun the program an hour early. For anyone who's not listening at the moment, and of course you wouldn't be able to hear me even if you tried, don't worry. We're going to be uploading to YouTube this segment of the program. It'll be available to you just as soon as we have our MP3 completed from the show's program, so probably sometime tomorrow or Tuesday. Those of you who are listening, of course, the reason I make mention of that is so that you can help spread the word via email, Skype, Facebook, et cetera, et cetera. Ladies and gentlemen, today, the 26th of June, Sunday, 2011, what an interesting time. There's the old Chinese proverb, may you live in interesting times, which is not intended really so much as a courtesy as it is a curse. And unfortunately, we find ourselves in the heart, in the midst of the most interesting of times. And as a result, there are so very many topics for us to address, these things that are happening in the news, these things that our so-called leaders are doing to us and at us and toward us with every passing day, things that we need to be very, very carefully aware of, and we need to build our awareness of these things quite rapidly. Today, we're going to be picking up some loose threads. If you were with our program last week, you heard our interview with Dr. Joseph Farrell. The main course of our discussion was built around his body of work covering roughly 1900, 1910, until after the conclusion of World War II and beyond, until the present day, in fact, but focused on the events happening in Europe, centered around the events of what we think of as Nazi-era Germany, the rise of fascism itself. Complicated subjects. If you were not able to join us live for last week's program and for that interview with Dr. Farrell, that also is available on YouTube. The channel is Crimson Pill TV, Crimson Pill TV channel on YouTube, to sort of pick up and recover the homework from the weeks past. The week before that, we were joined by Dr. Brooks Agnew, and we had a discussion of several disclosures that are being made by NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, who, through most of their course of existence, have wanted us to believe that they are a civilian space agency, when in fact they were chartered as a Department of Defense extension. All of the most interesting findings that they have made then, and in fact still until today, are considered classified at the moment of their discovery. We don't get to hear the very most important and interesting things, to say the least interesting, that NASA has discovered throughout their entire existence. What we receive are scraps from the table. What we receive are bits and pieces of disclosure that they make, veiled, hidden between the lines. And it is to that subject that I want to turn our discussion today in opening, before we're joined by our first guest, who has done some fascinating work himself, in fact, in the sense of reading between the lines, investigative research, cryptography, for those of you who are familiar with the subject. But we'll turn to our first guest here after some introductory remarks about our friends at NASA, who have been busy again in the course of disclosures, meta-disclosures, little bits and pieces that we are allowed to know. And in this case, I'm turning my attention to a recent article in space.com. The author is Joe. Joe, I'm sorry I don't pronounce your last name correctly. Raul? Rao? It's spelled R-A-O. Space.com, Friday, June 14th. Some of you, in fact, in the listening audience may have heard that we are about to be visited in a very close pass by an asteroid on Monday, tomorrow morning. You might be on your way to work, you might still be in bed, depending upon where it is that you live around the world. What you should know is that we will have an asteroid passing just 7,500 miles above Earth's surface, NASA officials say. At that particular moment, which is 9:26 a.m., Eastern Daylight Time, at that particular moment, we're going to be visited by this asteroid, which will be passing off the coast of Antarctica, almost 2,000 miles south-southwest of South Africa. The scientists, NASA officials, have named this asteroid, this object, 2011 MD. Now, what's so interesting about 2011 MD? Well, it was discovered Wednesday, June 22nd. That's correct. Discovered less than 5 days before it makes its pass over Earth. I use the term discovered loosely because NASA is well-armed with a range of instruments. They're capable with a range of observatory-type instruments, satellites, the WISE data, in this case what they call the Linear, a pair of robotic telescopes in New Mexico that scan the skies for near-Earth asteroids. So I say discovered loosely because I think more to point of fact, they are letting us know about this near-Earth object that's passing so close by, despite the fact that they quite likely have had knowledge of its presence long before Wednesday, June 22nd. But what is significant about this article is, once again, in the spirit of meta-disclosure, NASA is trying to let you know that objects that could pose some types of difficulties to us here on the surface of the Earth will literally be able to pop up out of nowhere, seemingly giving us only a few days, perhaps even less, advance notice before these objects come within the range of Earth that, once again, could cause problems for us on the surface. According to NASA's Near-Earth Object Office at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, an object of this size can be expected to come this close to Earth about every 6 years or so on average. Now, they go on to say in the article, asteroid 2011 MD measures about 10 meters, so that's roughly about 30 feet. Stony asteroids that are less than 25 meters would break up in Earth's atmosphere and not cause ground damage, Asteroid Watch says. That's comforting, of course, to know that this one happens to be small enough, but yet what about the next one that's going to pop up and give us only 3 or 4 days' notice, if that much? To continue with the article, the asteroid's upcoming Earth flyby will be a close shave, but not a record for nearby passing asteroids. The record is currently held by the asteroid 2011 CQ1, C as in cat, Q as in quickening, 1, which came within 3,400 miles of Earth on February 4th of this year. They call this a tricky sky-watching target. For several hours prior to its closest approach, 2011 MD will be visible in moderately large amateur telescopes, but despite its close approach, actually seeing this asteroid will not be an easy task. I'm going to skip farther down along the article to hit the other point of meta-disclosure that's being included. It falls under the section that's subtitled History of Near-Earth Asteroids. On October 28, 1937, German astronomer Karl Reinmuth, living 1892 to 1979, accidentally photographed the long trail of a fast-moving asteroid. 2 nights later, this asteroid passed within 460,000 miles of Earth. Reinmuth named it Hermes, after the Olympian god of boundaries and travelers. Since the vast majority of asteroids, so far numbering over 210,000, congregate between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, astronomers at that time felt that Hermes' very close approach was an outstanding exception. Remember, astronomers at that time. The following quote, astronomers of the day were somewhat biased, explained NASA asteroid scientist Paul Chodas, sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name. They had convinced themselves that collisions were too rare to consider. Since then, astronomers have learned that asteroids can make very close approaches to Earth with far greater frequency than previously thought. Asteroid 2011 MD's Monday pass is a prime example of such. Here's where we get to some meta-disclosure again, folks. Be ready to read between the lines, although your humble host will restate it quite overtly. Of the 8,099 near-Earth objects that have been discovered, and keep in mind, 2011 MD, the one that's coming to us tomorrow morning, was only discovered less than 5 days ago. So among the 8,099 that have been discovered, about 827 of them are asteroids with a diameter of approximately a half mile or larger. About 1,236 of these near-Earth objects have been classified as potentially hazardous asteroids, or in their nomenclature, the acronym PHAs. NASA currently plans to launch a probe to visit one of these potentially dangerous near-Earth objects and return samples of the asteroid to Earth. More of the meta-disclosure begins right now, folks, because what do they call this mission, this probe that they plan to launch? That mission will launch the OSIRIS-REx asteroid probe in 2016 to rendezvous with the space rock 1999 RQ-36 in the year 2020. The target asteroid is 1,900 feet, that's 580 meters wide, and has a 1 in 1,800 chance of hitting Earth in the year 2170, and a 1 in 1,000 chance of slamming into us in the year 2182. Those words, not those of your humble host, those of the author. Slamming into us, chance 1 in 1,000 in 2182. The author, Joe Rao, once again, sorry if I'm mispronouncing the name, serves as an instructor and guest lecturer at New York's Hayden Planetarium. He writes about astronomy for the New York Times and other publications. He is also an on-camera meteorologist for News 12 Westchester, New York. Now, the meta message. First, what is the name of that mission? It is OSIRIS-REx. If you are not familiar with what that means, first, do a Google search for OSIRIS, O-S-I-R-I-S, and you'll find OSIRIS's place in history, in ancient culture, some of which has been occulted over time. And the second half of the title of this mission is REx, R-E-X. Those of you who already have some basis in the Latin language understand that that means king. They've named this mission OSIRIS the King. Now, I turn my attention to some of their previous disclosure on this subject, dated May 25th, 2011. This comes from NASA.gov. It's a media advisory, NASA to announce new planetary science mission. Dateline Washington, NASA will host a media teleconference at 4:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Wednesday, May 25th, to discuss the selection of a future science mission that will usher in a, and I add emphasis here, new era in planetary exploration. Once again, I'm quoting directly from the media release. The emphasis is that of your host. Will usher in a new era in planetary exploration. Although the stated objective of this mission is to send a probe near an asteroid, in their own release they describe this as a new era in planetary exploration. Jim Green, director for NASA's Planetary Science Division mission in Washington, and other officials will take reporters' questions during the teleconference. Following the teleconference itself, NASA, on NASA.gov, dated May 25, 2011, issues the following more fully stated article about the mission. The title is NASA to Launch New Science Mission to Asteroid in 2016. I read from the first paragraph. NASA will launch a spacecraft to an asteroid in 2016 and use a robotic arm to pluck samples that could better explain our solar system's formation and how life began. The mission, called Origins Spectral Interpretation Resource Identification Security Regolith Explorer, or made into acronym form, OSIRIS-REx, OSIRIS the King, will be the first U.S. mission to carry samples from an asteroid back to Earth. Now, ladies and gentlemen, in the interest of time and in the interest of trying to make my way to our first guest, your humble host is going to stop short at this moment, but I think that you can sense the frustration and the passion in your host's voice when he describes this mission that has been named OSIRIS the King. Anyone in the listening audience, if you are of the Christian faith, perhaps Hindu, perhaps Buddhist, perhaps Jewish, perhaps you are a Muslim, perhaps you're an agnostic, maybe an atheist, whatever the case, can you picture the temerity for this agency, whose work, whose missions, whose toys are paid for with our tax dollars, to name this mission Osiris the King. Yes, NASA would have you believe that this is an acronym built upon the various aspects of the origin, the intent of this mission. Ladies and gentlemen, people have crafted acronyms for thousands of years. It's not necessary to call this Osiris the King. And I think that if you are on any of those spiritual paths, or once again, if you consider yourself agnostic or atheist, you might find yourself behooved to go to nasa.gov, www.nasa.gov. There you can find information, contact information for their Office of Public Affairs. I think Americans should be asking hard questions about how they have the temerity to name this supposedly benign mission Osiris the King. In the first edition of The Crimson Pill, internationally acclaimed author, lecturer, researcher, Mr. Jordan Maxwell told us that nothing in the world is as we think it is. In the second week of The Crimson Pill, we explored NASA's disclosures that they've made, most of them meta-disclosures, but the trail of evidence is unmistakable nonetheless. And in that mission, Dr. Brooks Agnew talked to us about the fact that various governments of the world, including the government of the United States, are spending exorbitant amounts of money to tunnel, to dig, to build underground structures. We also know of an endless chain of times and events in the course of this nation's history where the public has been misled or simply allowed to remain uninformed about topics, about subjects, about events that can affect us all. And yet, such knowledge held in the hands of the few is held dangerously, yes, held guardedly, yes, and held quietly nonetheless, despite its negative impact upon us. Well, we're going to set a few of these subjects to the side for the moment because I need to make time for our first guest. Mr. Ali Adams is a researcher in, and also I would consider him to be perhaps a polymath. He's got experience and expertise in more than one field. I'll begin to offer a brief introduction before bringing him into the program. After graduating with a master's degree in software engineering from Bournemouth University in England, Ali Adams worked as a software engineer with Racal Recorders, all the way up to a consultant with the world's number one object database vendor, Versant Incorporated. Physics is Ali's pet subject since his electrical engineering days in Iraq, which saw him graduate with a first degree, and thus was awarded a full 5-year scholarship to study in the United Kingdom for his master's and doctorate degrees. While studying for his PhD in intelligent data, which was sponsored by British Telecom, Ali was invited by the European Space Agency for his valuable experiment proposal to study the relationship between gravity and time dilation. At this point, listeners, you're invited to open a separate browser and make your way to helawave.com. That's www.helawave.com to learn more about his work. In 2001, Ali met the founder of a new physics theory called helical particle waves, and together they extended to it to give meaning to a highly sought-after question like what is mass, what is electric charge, and magnetic moment, details of which can also be found on the website helawave.com. After falling in love with prime numbers after reading the wonderful book Prime Obsession by John Derbyshire, Ali soon discovered the prime number pattern within the Quran. And that took him straight to the curious 31 repetitions of an exact verse in chapter called The Merciful of the Quran. His verse was the springboard for Ali's findings about events that he believes are predicted to come to pass in the year, in our Gregorian calendar year, 2012. All these pieces fell together as Ali's studies revealed the oft-repeated verses closely. At this time, I'd like to check with Don in the studio to see if we have Ali. Ali Adams, are you on the line, sir? Sounds like maybe we need to make either a reconnection or perhaps we've got an issue with Skype. Mr. Adams, if you're on the line, if you have the opportunity to discuss. And indeed, Don in the studio is telling me that we need to reconnect. with that in mind, we'll just begin with a brief discussion of cryptography. For those of us aren't aware, Ali Adams' background is in his education and background and career's work have been spent in cryptography. And cryptography itself is a very interesting subject. It is the practice and study of hiding information. What does that mean? Well, modern cryptography intersects the disciplines of mathematics, computer science, and electrical engineering. Applications of cryptography include ATM cards, computer passwords, and electronic commerce. A lot of people think cryptography. Well, that sounds a little bit like something from wartime era, from military operations, or perhaps intelligence operations. And that would be true. Cryptography has been essential in encrypting communications, essential to military operations, intelligence community operations, etc. We're just working on the side here, folks, to try to reestablish contact with Ali Adams. And in that light, continuing with cryptography, what most people don't understand is that actually cryptography is not just some subject that's limited to military functions or intelligence operations. Cryptography is something that is all present, all around us at all times, especially here in the computer age. Every time that you access your internet, every time that you do any commerce on the internet, cryptography is something that is ever present in our lives. When you find that you have a secure connection on the internet, what's occurring is that information from your computer is being encrypted as it's sent up. It's sent across, and then it is decrypted once it's brought down in order to maintain the security of that connection. How about ATM machines? Any of us that have an ATM card, we go to the ATM machine to get some cash. Once again, what you are experiencing is cryptography at work. Until modern times, cryptography referred almost exclusively to encryption, which is the process of converting ordinary information into unintelligible gibberish called ciphertext. Decryption is the reverse, in other words, moving from the unintelligible ciphertext back to plain text. What it basically requires, in layman's terms, you begin with a message that you need to send and you need it to be remain private. You need it to remain undiscovered by anyone between the sender and receiver. That message is encrypted on this end, and then when it's received by the receiver by some method, by one or another, usually what we would refer to as a public key and a private key, the message is decrypted. Okay, it sounds like Don in the studio has told us that we have Ali Adams on the line now. Ali Adams, are you there, my friend?
Yes, my brother.
Hello. It's very good to have you on the program. I would like to say good day to you, sir. Welcome to the show, and how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, and thank you very much for having me on the show.
Yes, it's absolutely my pleasure. I have found your work, your research, to be more than fascinating. I find it to be essential. Ali, while you're on the line, or while we were trying to reestablish connection with you, I began a bit of a description, a discussion of what cryptography is itself, and so I think we've kind of laid a bit of groundwork for that.
Excellent.
I wonder if you might begin by telling us about your own experience in cryptography and a bit about how that has led you to some of these findings that we'll discuss more fully later in the program.
Certainly, thank you. Well. I am a software engineer. So in software engineering, we do lots of networked software. That is, software uses servers and clients. And it's essential that nobody breaks through and pretends that they are fake clients and so on. So we have to use cryptology to protect all the communication between all servers and clients. And since 1978, there is a new public cryptology, public key cryptology, that utilizes prime numbers, So we don't have to share keys between the sender and the receiver anymore. This is a big advancement actually in public key cryptology. Before that, they had to share either books or private keys, or they had to actually have face-to-face contact to exchange keys before they can send the message over insecure channels. But with the prime numbers, basically any one-way functions, they call them. So it's very easy to calculate the result, but very difficult to get the input from the result, these functions, which prime numbers exhibit this feature. It is possible to exchange secure information securely on insecure channels. Okay, I'll give you examples later. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. Well, what I have found to be very interesting about cryptography is that, of course, today in the computer age, as you mentioned, it's become essential to find ways of making the encryption much more difficult to crack, to solve, for someone who might be trying to intercept the communication. And yet in cryptography, it's been around for an extensive amount of time, even before the Roman Empire. And as I did a bit of my research, I was fascinated to learn that even in our own American Revolution, for example, George Washington and those folks were using cryptography in a sense to communicate their messages securely. And at that time, it was as simple as using a commonly agreed upon book. Maybe it was Moby Dick, or maybe it was actually even a version of the Bible, the King James Version in particular. And so cryptography now, of course, has become much more complicated, but the concept has been around and in use for quite some time.
Yes, ever since man probably wanted to exchange secret information. We have lots of evidence for that since 1000 before BC, actually, BC, okay? So basically, most of the methods started first by exchanging letters, probably. Then they started doing letter frequency, using letter frequency, or even letter positions, and so on. But all these methods had to use an agreed-upon key in advance. So even with these books, the book itself, actually, the James book and so on, you could think of them as the private key, the key that is agreed upon. And then when you have a message, you could encrypt it with a public key, and then you look up the book and you extract from the public key the private key, and then you unlock the message. With the prime numbers, the idea is as follows, and it's really a very simple idea, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Suppose I give you the number. First of all, let me define prime numbers, please, for the listeners, okay?
Very good idea, yes.
I don't want people to sort of mix them up with the odd numbers, for example, okay?
Yes.
You could think of prime numbers as the mothers of their multiples. So, for example, 2, which is an even number, is actually responsible for generating all the even numbers.
So, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, all these even numbers, you could think of them as children of 2. And all of them are composite. Only 2 is the prime number for this group of numbers.
Okay.
After 2, you get 3. 3 also a prime number, that is a generator, a number generator, a mother, and generates all its multiples, the 6, 9. 9 is odd, but it's not a prime number. It's composite, okay? Composite mm-hmm. from 3 and so on.
Because once again, a prime number is a number that is divisible only by itself and 1.
Yes, indeed. But really, divisibility by 1 never divides any number into any smaller parts, so it's not divisible by 1. That's just mathematically things. And divisible by itself, it just makes it into ones. So if you have, for example, 7 cubes, for example, you put them vertically in one column, then if you divide them into 7 columns, then all you did actually just move the column from vertical to horizontal. Okay? So these prime numbers are called unbreakable numbers. Okay?
Unbreakable.
Yes, you could think of them as unbreakable numbers. Actually, they call them standalone numbers as well.
Okay,
as we will see later.
Mm-hmm.
So, but basically, the nicest way to think of them is mothers of their multiples. So you have 2, 3, then 4 is a child of 2, so it's not a prime number, so you get 5. Then you get 7. Then not 9. 9 is divisible by 3. Okay,
right.
So you get 11. And then 13. Then 17. Then 19. 23. 29. 31. And so on. And
yes.
the gap between these prime numbers is so mysterious that there is a $1 million prize by the Clay Mathematics Institute here in Boston, for whomever can crack the Riemann hypothesis. And the Riemann hypothesis is related to the gap between the prime numbers.
Yes. Now, if I may interrupt, a $1 million prize might sound very attractive, and I hope our listeners are not going to distract their attention away from our conversation to begin working on that puzzle in the interest of the $1 million. Firstly, because they won't crack that during the course of this show, it's best to keep listening. And secondly, the $1 million, as attractive as it sounds, is minor in comparison to what the discovery itself would actually be worth. Is that right?
Exactly. You're absolutely right. You've done great research. So this $1 million isn't actually that attractive when you know that if you can find an equation for describing the nth prime number, that is, you find the gap between them and you know where is the 100th prime number or the 1 millionth prime number and so on, then you could possibly be able to crack all the secret messages exchanged between countries, for example, although they use very long prime numbers. But once you get into the basics of it and crack the most important question about prime numbers, which is what is the relationship between them as prime numbers, if you know that, you could use other methods to be able to gradually crack messages between even countries, spy on them basically, espionage, and without them knowing as well. Okay, yes. So we could potentially already have somebody who cracked the code and they don't let us know about it, okay?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder if we could do this. It is my hope. We have a guest that has been part of our plan to be on the program for some length of time. He is Dr. Stanley Monteith, and he'll be joining us at the top of the hour. And Mr. Adams, your work, it is so fascinating, and I believe it is so critical for our listening audience to build our understanding of this topic as soon as possible, that as we run out of time in our first hour segment, I wonder if we might turn our conversation toward painting a sort of a big picture sense of your work. So in other words, we're gonna kind of jump to some of the final conclusions, if you will, some of the headlines of your work. And then my hope is that I could bring you back midway through the third hour of the program, that we could continue the discussion about some of the elements that contribute toward this, the prime numbers themselves and some of the numerology, et cetera. Would that sound agreeable? Do you think you might have availability to rejoin us in the third hour to provide more depth to our discussion?
Certainly. And I'll be happy to explain actually the overview of my research in a short time to the listeners to get them attracted really to see what actually the results are, okay? And then
yes.
Once they realize what the effect of this result that will affect everybody on Earth, okay?
Yes.
Then hopefully they will be glued to your extreme radio show.
Well, I hope that you're right with that as well. And what drew me to your work was my research in preparation for our program 2 weeks ago pertaining to NASA disclosures and pertaining to the comet Elenin, or as some pronounce it, Elenin.
Elenin.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And in my research of that comet, of that body, of which there's a great deal of argument and discussion, is it actually even a comet? Is it nothing more than an asteroid? Or is it actually potentially a brown dwarf star? Or is it potentially one of these rogue free-floating planets that we discussed 2 weeks ago on our program? So there are a lot of ifs and a lot of questions, but what I found most intriguing about your work is specificity, and specificity that is based upon, number one, mathematics, and mathematics that are very easily provable, verifiable, in particular how they utilize the prime numbers. And so, having said what I've said just now, could you maybe begin your comments with telling our listening audience why it is so important that they hear this message and come to understand more fully these connections between prime numbers and the text, the content of the Islamic holy book, the Quran?
Certainly. And probably just before that, I will just spend 1 minute teasing the listeners probably with
yes.
the movie with the movie Contact. If you ever watched the movie Contact, okay,
yes.
What they do, they first receive prime numbers as heartbeats. So they'll have tup, tup, like 2 beats, and then tup, 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 3 beats, 5 beats, 7 beats, 11 beats. And once they establish these beats are prime numbers, they knew immediately that the source of the information is an intelligent source. And when they found that the source of the information is not local to Earth, but somewhere near Star Vega, then they knew whoever sent this message, it's an important message. And that's why they continued working on it, not ignoring it. And they found within the message audio-video messages, and these audio-video messages were just a recording of from Earth, were broadcast on the first television broadcast of Earth, that initially they thought, oh, this is they just telling us, we heard you, okay? But yes. later what they found, which was extremely interesting as well, and we have similarity in the text of the Quran to it, is actually the audio-video signal had a polarization on it, a modulation. And the polarization, sometimes the wave, the electromagnetic wave was going clockwise, sometimes anti-clockwise. So when they converted all these into binary digits, zeros and ones, then they found about 10,000 pages of zeros and ones, and they didn't know what to do with it until somebody helped them with the key to unlock it. And once they unlocked it, they found it's a spaceship machine, designed for a spaceship machine. So in the Quran, which is the holy book of Islam, God also challenges us, first swears by these prime numbers. It says, it calls them the standalone, okay? The
yes.
This is in Quran 89, verse 3, okay? And also tells us that you people and jinn, that is plasma-based beings or smokeless fire beings, you will not be able to go through the orbits of the heavens and earth unless you have something. That's something called sultan or power or whatever. And I believe because the Quran has something binary in it, which is later we could discuss on a different program probably, cracking that binary system may lead us to this machine, which allows us to go through the orbits of the space, okay? And God knows best. So okay. let me just go back how I got interested in this one and how I noticed the prime numbers in the Quran, okay?
Yes.
The first thing, in the Quran is 114 chapters. On the first chapter is called the key or the opener, but most people misunderstand and they call it introduction, unfortunately. And that key is only 7 verses. And everybody knows that. Nobody tries to go beyond that, unfortunately. If you ask people how many words, how many letters, they say, never thought of counting. So when I realized that the number of words and letters are also prime numbers, so it's not only 7 verses, but 29 words and 139 letters, okay, that piqued my interest. And I started, that's a prime number, and the chapter called The Key, and I work with cryptology, and we use prime numbers as keys. So this chapter is not an introduction, it's a key. But key to what? It must be key to unlocking the rest of the Quran. But hang on a second, like the whole Quran is 114 chapters. Okay, so if we split it into two parts, a key and a message, we find the message is 113 chapters. 113 is also a prime number. Interesting. What about the verses? What about the verses? Glory to him. The verses are following the same pattern. Also, we have 6,236 verses in total. 7 of them, we said, for this chapter, the key, and 6,229 for the rest of the Quran, which is, again, a prime number. But in cryptology, we use long prime numbers. God here using very small numbers. Why would he just use this one? What I realized later that these are not any prime numbers. They are very special prime numbers in the fact that the digits of each one of them, the sum of the digits, is also a prime. So if you take the number, for example, 29 words, so 2 plus 9 is 11, also a prime. The same with all the other prime numbers, the 139, the 113, the 6229, and so on.
I see.
All of them prime numbers, and their digit sum also prime. And these numbers, they call additive prime numbers. Okay? So God is using these ones, additive special type of prime numbers, which are like double rare or more rare or rarer than prime numbers themselves. Prime numbers are rare as you go up. but they never end. Okay, there's an infinite number of them.
I see.
But prime numbers that are additive prime numbers, they are half the other numbers, or half of the prime numbers. Okay, so they are rarer.
Hmm.
But all this, still, I was a bit skeptic on friends and families. They say this could be a coincidence. But when I found that joining these numbers, putting them next to each other, concatenation, the seven verses, 29 words, 139 letters, left to right or right to left, also produced a prime number. So it's 729139 or 139297. Both of them are prime numbers, which means they are mothers of their multiples. Not odd, they are multiples. They are new mothers, okay? Mm-hmm. And the sum of the digits, each one of them is a 31, which is also prime. So they are additive prime numbers. Once I found this one, I knew that God is telling us that this chapter is to be treated as a key, not just introduction.
I see.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also there is a verse actually confirming this division, which says we have given you the seven most repeated verses and the Grand Quran. And the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, when asked what are these seven most repeated verses, and he said these are the key verses, okay? Surah Al-Fatiha.
And this is maybe a point where I think it would be good to make mention of the idea that I think oftentimes folks who have been on one spiritual path maybe for their entire life, oftentimes people, the spiritual path that they select for themselves is that they were raised into a family. For example, if a person is born into a family of Protestants, you know, maybe they're Lutherans or maybe they're Baptists, they oftentimes follow that same spiritual path their entire life. And sometimes I think it leads to some misinformation or a lack of understanding of some of the other paths and what are really tremendous similarities between the paths as opposed to differences. I've found in my own research and in my life, for example, that Islam and Christianity, they're so very, very, very much more closely related than what there are differences between the practices and beliefs of these paths. Would you find that to be fair to say?
Of course, of course. And even I would add that whatever might happen next year, and I hope it happens, will actually unite all people around the earth, regardless of religion.
Okay? Yes.
As I will explain in a moment, okay?
And I think that the reason I made mention of this is because at this mm-hmm. point, I want anyone who they maybe have been Christians their lifetime or maybe it's some other path, but the Quran itself, some folks may not be aware of its origin. I hope that you would add more fully. I'll just try to state very quickly that it was received by the Prophet Muhammad from the Archangel Gabriel that many Christians are familiar with from their own spiritual path. And so what I find that's interesting about the analogy that you made earlier to the movie Contact, in that movie, it was a message that was received from the heavens, and it was encoded with prime numbers.
Indeed.
And to be fully understood here on Earth by us, by humans, we had to crack that code of prime numbers to understand the message received from the heavens. And I find it to be a truly fascinating analogy, more so than an analogy, a direct linkage toward this experience that you're talking about with the message in the Quran.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I'm thankful for you to have raised this, actually, because what we say in Islam, that the Quran was revealed in one go from the seventh heaven to the third heaven, and then the arch-rival Jibreel, Angel Jibreel, revealed by the order of God the message over 23 years, lunar years, okay, or Islamic years, okay, to the Prophet, peace be upon him. And the way it was revealed is not the same in the same order as we have it now. So the order is as if it's shuffled by God to keep the code intact. But the revelation where whenever there is some occasion, it will be revealed for that occasion, part of it, and so on. And the revelations, interesting things about it, sometimes you get a whole chapter revealed in one go, and sometimes you get a verse that is revealed in two even different cities, like Mecca and Medina, the same verse. But when you look at the Quran, you see, why these ones have been put together, okay? And if we look at the Quran, God says, I revealed the Quran to you in an Arabic tongue. Now, the Quran is very precise when it talks. Okay, God when talking the Quran. So he would never use an extra word for nothing, unless it means something. So why wouldn't he say just we reveal the Quran in Arabic? Okay, he would say in an Arabic tongue. Okay, and what I found, and even the name, the Quran, actually, the name Quran means the readable, that readability of the Quran is Arabic. But the text itself is deviate from the Arabic deliberately. Sometimes you have extra letters. Sometimes you have missing letters. Sometimes you have exchange letters. Sometimes you have the split between the words and not the way we would write it in Arabic. Okay?
I see. I see.
And we have, for example, there are 114 chapters. 29 of these chapters, when they start, the first verse of them is just single letters, like a few letters, Alif, Lam, Mim, A-L-M, for example, which nobody in the whole world knows what they mean. Okay? So these are like local keys to the chapter.
I see.
Yeah. So the revelation was over 23 years, yes, but was revealed in one night, in the Ramadan night, that's what the Quran says itself, and that revelation came to the third heaven. Now, this Quran, God guarantees its authenticity throughout time. And nobody, not Muhammad, not any human, not any even being from outer space could guarantee that. Okay? Because they all die. They cannot guarantee something after they die. So the Quran, as it is now, we have it exactly as it was before. But the only differences are adding extra diacritics, for example, on top to keep it readable for us, because the Arabs then they when they look at the word, just like in English, when you read the word, when you look at some, for example, SMS even messages, you say later, for example, when you write, okay, these short words, okay,
which are,
yeah. So these short words, we get used to them so much. The Arabs used to the Quran without even dots. Then they realized for the non-Arab people, they had to add dots to them. But they knew there are dots here, but they never wrote them. They wrote dots. Then they wrote diacritics. But throughout time, it never changes. The text is exactly the same text. And
yes.
God guaranteeing the preservance of it. And this is why there is a verse in the Quran itself. It says, whatever verse or sign, some people say it's a sign, not verse, we revealed to you, we could edit or cause it to be forgotten. Okay, cause it to be forgotten.
Okay.
So we bring a similar or a better one. And normally God would say, God is capable of doing anything. He says, don't you know that God is capable of doing everything? So God is capable of updating the Quran in real time. Okay, to suit different times without us, all of us knowing. It will be updated in all hard copies, in CDs, in computers, in our minds, in all the interpretations of it. And we would not be able to, because that's what God says. God says, don't you know that God is capable of doing anything? Is a strong emphasis there.
I see.
Yeah. So when we find that the Quran at this time, when human being advanced in computer science and cryptology using prime numbers, revealing to us or showing us prime numbers are the key to unlocking some of its secrets, okay? We cannot ignore it. We should all unite together and find it. And the unification factor will be next year's events, okay? 2012 events.
Very definitely. And I apologize to interrupt, but we have only just a few more minutes here briefly. Before I have our other guest, and again, I apologize, but due to his scheduling, we'll need to bring him in. Could we spend this last roughly 4 minutes here? Could you set the stage, an overview of the events, your findings, what you believe that the Quran instructs us as to what to expect, and the window of time coming up? And then when we come back in the third hour, we'll again speak more toward the methodology of your approach to discover these findings.
Okay, indeed, yes. So what I found from the Quran, that there is a chapter which has a often repeated verse, a lot of the verse repeated so many times that it was begging to be counted how many times it's repeated. And it was repeated a prime number of times. And when you add the number of the verse numbers that the verse repeats at, okay, these numbers of the same verse, also gives you an additive prime number. And when you see that this additive prime number is referring to 2012, but not specifically actually to the Islamic year 1433, which is next year. Current Islamic year is 1432. Then it overlaps 2012. And specifically, this is a number. We cannot guarantee it's a year, but God gave us a hint, a strong hint, that this is a year by making the number of words in this chapter, the chapter that contains these verses, equals exactly the number of a Hijri year, of an Islamic year, and not any Islamic year. It has to be a leap year. When you go to next year, 1433 after Hijra, after migration of the Prophet, you find it has exactly the same numbers because it's a leap year. And this is where we get all the events, which would be each event. We don't know exactly what they could be, but most likely meteorite showers over 31 latitudes all around the Earth. And because the latitude is wide, I believe and hope that it will miss deliberately. God will miss all religious places, regardless of religion, to show that we all worship the same one God. And because the Quran is telling us where the next event is, then we should pay more attention to it and start respecting Islam, basically.
Very interesting, very interesting. And now, just a kind of a brief overview of, it is a set of events, I think, that you identify as being about 4 days in length.
Yes.
Could you talk to us a little bit again about Elanine, your thoughts, a projection about what you see as this connection?
Sorry, I didn't talk details. I thought I didn't have time. Certainly. What I found first, there are 31 repetitions of the same verse, very dense repetitions, every second verse almost, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And these verses, each one of them is four words. And the whole chapter has exactly the same number of days, words, as days in the year. And the sum of these 31 verse numbers points to next year, 1433 in Islamic, I think, which actually starts in November this year and ends November next year. So each word maps to a day. 355 words maps to a 355 days in a leap Islamic year, a lunar year. And that means there would be 31 events. Each event would last 4 days because the verse has four words in it.
Yes.
And the gaps between the events, the same as the number of words between these this repeated verse.
Yes. And your feeling is that these events, the first window being the 7th through the 10th of January of 2012, what will be occurring in those windows, in those events?
Whatever it is occurring, it must be coming from outer space, because when I assume that something going to come from outer space, say meteorite shower, or even going through the tail of this comet Elanine, okay, and the tail could be made of lots of different density areas, and we go through them as if they were stripes, for example. So each stripe we go through it is like for 4 days. The most important thing I found is, if you assume the event coming from outer space, then it will be hitting or bombarding Earth on one point, but the Earth is spinning around itself as normal. Every day spins once.
Yes.
So in 4 days, it will have spun four times. And that means there will be a trail left over all around the Earth on a circle. And these circles called latitudes. And God has given us 31 latitudes. So that proves that it will be from outer space. Now, where are these 31 latitude numbers? A latitude at the equator is zero, and then you go 1, 2, 3 up to the North Pole, which is 90, or you go down south, so it's 1, 2, 3 up to 90 south. So we need some numbers that fit between 0 and 90. And God made these verse numbers, the one we added up and we got 1433 from, sit exactly in the middle of it. The first one is 13, so it's latitude 13, north or south, we don't know. And the last one, 77, latitude 77. And the distance from 0 to 13, or the difference between 13 and 0, is 13. The same, the difference between 77 and 90. So these numbers fit exactly within the range of latitudes. So God is telling us indirectly that these are to be used as latitudes, and the events have to be from outer space, not like a volcano in one place. So it's not 31 pinpoint locations, no, 31 circles all around the Earth.
Right, and that it makes a perfect sense in the idea that there's this window of approximately 4 days in length, because as you mentioned, as the Earth rotates, as it makes each 24-hour rotation, it completes one Earth day for us. What we find is that in the evening, for example, of a person standing outside, or even just the path of the sun across the sky in the daytime, that path is dictated as a result of Earth's rotation. And so the pattern of the stars that we see as they move across the night sky, that pattern is seemingly created. The direction that they seeming to flow or to pass through the sky is dictated as a result of the tilt of the Earth's axis and the fact that we're rotating. That's what creates that plane of the ecliptic, so to speak. And so, as a result, in your findings, what you're seeing is that some sort of events coming from the heavens will cause a reaction along that latitude and a specific band of Earth latitude over the span of approximately 4 days, and that there will be 31 of these windows of events of 4 days, beginning roughly January the 7th, and then ending with the last window of events being November the 4th through the 7th. Is that fair to say?
That's correct, except it is exactly 4 days, not approximately 4 days. Each okay. event, yeah, it will be exactly 4 days. So what I want people to sort of imagine or visualize is, if your city to be hit today, it will be hit for example, 5 to 10 minutes, and then the shower keeps continuing to the next city, a village or so. So it goes all around. Now, tomorrow, it will be exactly at the same time, okay? Exactly after 24 hours, it will come to you. And mm-hmm. then the day after and the day after, 4 days.
Well, yeah, actually, it'll be precisely 23 hours and 56 minutes as opposed to 24 hours. Is that right, my friend?
Why 56 minutes?
There you have it. Yes, the sidereal day as opposed to the actual. So 23 hours and 56 minutes apart as opposed to 24.
Yes, yes, certainly. You're absolutely right. Thank you.
Yes.
But we need to let people not to panic. If you panic, okay, you will lose yourself and soul maybe. What you should do, you should only pray to God that God will use you as a tool to warn others. You don't have to believe me now. You could wait for the first few events. America is far away from these events. Like the first event will be after maybe a few months. In July, I think, starts, whereas the events start in January. Then if you actually say to God that I will be your light, okay? So yes. you become a guiding light for others. Then God will preserve you, okay, to use you as a tool.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. This is the philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm very curious, though, still to hear just a bit more about your maybe thinking or theories. I understand that in all of this realm, none of us can be 100% certain about 100% of our findings. Some of it has to be a bit of conjecture, but if you talk more about Elenin and how it might be related to these sequence of events, how would you connect the dots for our listeners to know how we get from Comet Elenin to how these might be occurring?
Okay. What first, before I knew about Elenin, because this work, remember, started in 2008, so nobody knew about the Comet Elenin. It's only December last year, I think, we heard of Elenin. I was thinking, if it was a meteorite shower, okay, where would the source of that meteorite shower be? Okay, and what I thought then, everybody was talking about Planet X, Nibiru, and so on. I thought, if this theory is correct, maybe the governments of the world would actually bombard this object, whatever it is coming, with laser. They cannot bombard it with the missiles because it has to be far away to be throwing its debris on us for 10 months from January to November, okay? Mm-hmm. So initially I thought it would be exploded with laser, and then we would get 31 patches of debris, and this debris will be 4 days each patch. That's what I thought. Then when we heard of this Elenin coming close, okay, and every time actually it aligns with the sun and the earth, we would have a great earthquake like the one in Chile and the one in Christchurch in New Zealand and the one in Japan. They are within like 1-2 days of alignment with the sun. And people saying Elenin isn't really a comet, cannot have affect us from that far. So the scenario still exists. It could either be non-comet, So it's something big, and they would destroy it with laser. Or it could be a comet that comes very close, and we cannot do anything about it, and we could go through the tail of it.
Interesting, interesting.
Just like the great flood of Noah. Okay. I believe the great flood of Noah, we passed through the tail of a comet for 40 days and nights, and it was just continuous rain. It could even be rain, what we're going to see. The most important thing is the Quran tells you 31 events. Each event will be 4 days, and these events, the first one, as you rightly said, will be from the 7th to the 10th of January 2012. And the last event would be from the 4th to the 7th of November. This is all well before the Mayan calendar, Winter Solaris Day, the 21st of December 2012. But we need to know that the Hijri calendar itself has a few errors in it, like 22 days. So that might affect things.
Tell us that calendar again. What is that called?
The Hijri calendar. Hijri calendar is... We started when the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family migrated from Mecca to Medina when Islam became public. Before that was secret. Mm-hmm. And so it's the birth of Islam. And on that date, which was somewhere, we could say the third month of the Arabic calendar, they had an Arabic calendar then, that was the beginning of the calendar. But unfortunately, when they, 17 years after this event, they decided to make an Islamic calendar, not to use the Arabic calendar anymore, they had to compromise and make the Islamic calendar start on the first of the first of the Arabic calendar. So that's one source of error there. And the other error as well, the Arabic calendar, they used to add a leap month, an extra month, every 3 years, because it's a lunar calendar, to keep it in sync with the solar year, with the seasons.
I see.
And this happened 3 times before God Almighty in the Quran forbade them from doing so, precisely. Okay, to keep the month of fasting, the month of Ramadan, cycling through the season. So not some people in one part of the earth always have summer, Ramadan and during the summer, so it's harder on them, and the others easier for them. So why would God wait until they have made it 3 times, adding three months, extra months, and then forbade it? God controls everything, and I believe the calendar we have now is deliberately designed to be as it is now, even with these two errors. So for now, whenever the first event happens, whenever, it doesn't matter when, but we, according to the calculation, it's the 7th of January 2012. But whenever it happens, it means the event after, on the next latitude 16, the first one 13, the next latitude 16, will be up to 11 days, because there are 11 words between the first repeated verse and the second repeated verse. And the next one after 4 days, the next one after 7 days. Sometimes there is only one word between them, so there is 1 day rest, if you'd like.
And start, I see. Mr. Adams, I apologize to interrupt. I've been informed from the studio that we're ready to make a transition to our other guest. If it is possible, I'm very hopeful that we'll have some time to maybe continue our discussion in the third hour. At the very least, I know that if your schedule is amenable to the notion that we'll have a longer discussion next week where we can entertain some calls from the listening audience. But my hope is still today. So. I'm very sorry to.
I'll be very happy listening to you and your guest, brother. Just continue, please.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you again so much for your time. I think we're off to a good discussion and set the table well for when we're able to continue. Mr. Adams, thanks again for your time. We'll hopefully be back with you in maybe about 90 minutes, or at the very least next week we'll have a much longer discussion. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to BBSRadio.com. This program is called The Crimson Pill. I'm your host, Antonin Fiore. We're going to take a break right now, about a four-minute break approximately, and then after which we'll be joined by Dr. Stanley Monteith. I'm sure that many of you are already familiar with Dr. Monteith's work. He's been active in lecturing. He's written numerous white papers, also books. He has had DVDs and CDs and audio interviews that I'm sure many of you have experienced. And yet I know that several of us in the listening audience will be new to Dr. Monteith's work, and I think that we have a fascinating conversation in front of us. So At this moment, at 6 minutes after the hour on bbsradio.com, we'll take a very short break, after which we're joined by Dr. Stanley Monteith.
Creator and sustainer of all the worlds, whether those worlds are known or unknown to mankind. Creator and sustainer of all the worlds. Of all the worlds. Worlds, 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 worlds. All the worlds. Creator and sustainer of all the worlds, whether those worlds are known or unknown to mankind.
BBSradio.com. If it's not mainstream, it could be here. Information and knowledge bring humanity closer to truth.
And ladies and gentlemen and the listening audience of the Crimson Pill, welcome back from our break. It is a distinct pleasure and honor for me to introduce our following guest, Dr. Stanley Monteith. Dr. Monteith has been bringing you the story behind the story and the news behind the news for years, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and illusion, unfortunately, is usually king. But in the battle for the survival of Western civilization as we know it, it will be reality and not illusion or delusion that will determine what the future will bring. That's Radio Liberty, and Dr. Monteith can be heard regularly on Radio Liberty, and we'll talk more about the time and location for you to find his information on Radio Liberty. For over a decade prior to his retirement, Dr. Monteith led a delegation of physicians from Santa Cruz County to the House of Delegates of the California Medical Association. For 10 years, he led the battle within organized medicine in California to address the AIDS epidemic as a medical issue rather than a civil rights issue. As a result of his experiences trying to implement an effective medical approach to the HIV epidemic, he wrote the book AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic, the widely circulated pamphlet To Deceive a Nation, and more recently, A Nation Deceived and Betrayed. Supported by physicians across our nation, his public health approach to the HIV epidemic was eventually accepted by the California Medical Association. Unfortunately, powerful forces continue to oppose the dictates of doctors. Dr. Monteith currently spends 5 hours daily on talk radio in California. He writes extensively and lectures on geopolitics. He has spent more than 30 years researching the causes for America's spiritual and moral decline. May I just say, Dr. Stanley Monteith, thank you so much for your time to be a part of our program. Welcome to the show, and how are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. You know, that must have been written a long time ago because I've been at this for 49 years.
49 years.
We've been trying to educate people about what's going on. We've certainly learned a lot during that period of time. In fact, never a day goes by that we don't learn. And you were talking about my experience with the California Medical Association. Of course, I dropped out there probably about 1995. I think that was the last year I went, when we got a standing ovation from the doctors, House of Delegates of the California Medical Association. Only the second time in the 15 years I was there I saw the standing ovation. But it didn't matter that the doctors wanted to try to stop the AIDS epidemic. Hierarchy of organized medicine blocked the implementation of public health measures then. They're blocking the implementation of public health measures now, and people are dying throughout the world, but not just from AIDS. They've already killed at least 1.5 billion people. They're killing millions of people every day. They intend to kill billions of people more. And of course, that takes us into the Georgia Guidestones, because I will have to admit that when I wrote my book, AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic, that's AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic, it's available on Amazon or through my ministry. It was written about in the early 1990s. I really didn't believe, I didn't want to believe, I couldn't bring myself to accept the fact there really were people then as now who want to kill off the majority of the world's population. That Dr. Mengele, the angel of death in Germany, was not an aberration. He was representative of a group of people who existed in Germany and funded from the United States who have a worldwide genocidal agenda. There really are evil people in the world, which, of course, takes us into the Georgia Guidestones, because the thing that finally convinced me that there is a population control agenda, that genocide is being carried out today, was going to Elberton, Georgia, and standing in the shadows of this great Druid monument. And I say Druid because it's fashioned, at least to some extent, after the Druid monument in England, the so-called
Stonehenge
monument,
I believe,
that they have over there. The monument that exists there in Great Britain, and it was built by the Druids, and certainly it is known as Stonehenge. That's the the English Stonehenge, and of course we have here in America the American Stonehenge, known as the Georgia Guidestones.
Yes.
And they're in 8 different languages, chiseled into these gigantic, great big pieces of granite that are aligned with the stars and the moon and the North Star. Our 10 commandments that come from the very pit of hell, the monument was put up by a secret society. Now, we're not supposed to believe in secret societies. Anybody who believes in secret societies is immediately labeled as some sort of a kook, and, oh, you believe there's a conspiracy. No, I don't believe there's a conspiracy. I know there's a conspiracy. I've had too many of my friends murdered or certainly bribed or certainly offered to be bribed with countless millions of dollars if they just be quiet about what's really going on. But there at the Georgia Guidestones, in the languages of Arabic and Hindu and Spanish and Swahili and Russian and English and Chinese, are simply the Ten Commandments put forward by the secret society. Point number one is maintain humanity at 500 million in constant balance with nature. Maintain humanity at 500 million in constant balance with nature.
That even means they're planning on killing first off point by itself is
well over 90% of the population of the world, and these people are deadly, deadly serious.
Even that first point by itself is rather chilling, is it not?
It certainly is. The rest of the points deal with world government, certainly this new spirituality that will come along and replace the old spirituality. And I mean, the monument was put up by a man who called himself R.C. Christian, but that wasn't his name. Everybody knows that he readily acknowledged he was part of a secret society. So why aren't we reading and hearing about this secret society? For the same reason you're not reading about, hearing about all the other secret societies. That is because in America we have freedom of the press. And that means if you the people who own the press have the perfect freedom to suppress information, and they do. And the media is controlled by predominantly by 6 major corporations. They control 90 to 95% of the media corporations in America. They're specific AOL, Time Warner, although they've divided, they still all owe their allegiance to the same force. Bertelsmann, which is a German corporation, Viacom, which controls CBS, Disney, which controls ABC, GE, which has a great media empire. They recently sold NBC to Comcast. And then Rupert Murdoch, who controls the Wall Street Journal, who controls Fox News, who controls the largest Christian publisher in the United States, probably the largest Christian publisher in the world, and is systematically doing everything they can to undermine and destroy Christianity, as they have with this new gender-neutral Bible that talks about not God as he, but as he, she, and does everything they can to confuse, destroy, and undermine our belief in the Lord who created this heaven and this earth. Well, there are evil people in the world today. Every one of the corporations ties into the Council on Foreign Relations, which is located at 58 East 68th Street in New York. 58 East 68th Street in New York. It is a front for a secret society that was established in 1891 to bring about a one-world government, a one-world religion, and install the coming world leader. And you can verify that fact on pages 951 and 952 of Professor Quigley's a prophetic book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. And he wasn't on our side, he was on the other side. He thought they were the hope of the world. Well, they are the curse of the world, but that's another story in itself. But basically, I've been to the headquarters of the Council on Foreign Relations. I spent weeks there going through their open and some of their concealed secret records, and we have a great deal of information about that and about all the other secret societies as laid out in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which is, if you want to study about this, that's where you begin. The Brotherhood of Darkness, available from Radio Liberty.
Quite right. And in fact, you know, along the subjects, Dr. Monteith, that you have explored during the course of your work and your career, probably to me the most chilling, because of its implications, would have to be the entire notion of the population control agenda. And you just made mention of your book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which I highly recommend to the folks in the listening audience, and included as well some of your other works, The Planned Police State, The Oil Deception, which I think was a collaboration with Pastor Lindsey Williams, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
Yeah,
I use a lot of his information there.
And also, of course, the AIDS, the unnecessary epidemic, and then also the work, the Bilderbergers. I guess I have to confess to the listening audience, I think I recommend everything that you've done along the road. But, of course, all of us have only, you know, 24 hours in most of our days. And to me, those are some of the real significant parts of your work that I would consider a sort of a priority for people who are new to your work. This subject that we're going to be discussing, the population control agenda, that, well, we can find those extensions from the planned police state, the Bilderbergers, the oil deception. Where should we turn our attention to next, do you think, Dr. Monteith?
You call it and we'll go there. But basically, let's talk a little bit. You mentioned the Bilderbergers. We carry a book written on the Bilderbergers by Daniel Estulin, and we carry a second book as well. And in that second book, he opens by talking about how several representatives of the Bilderbergers came to him. And they said, you know, certainly we represent this Bilderberger group, and we would prefer that you did not write further or do any further research on the Bilderberger. And here is a check. And according to him, they handed him a check, and he looked at it, and it was signed and dated, but there was no sum of money on it. And he said, well, how much is the check for? And they said, you fill it in. You fill it in.
Oh, my.
Andre Gersi claims that he gave them the check back and said, I'm not for sale. They made a very similar offer to Alex Jones. He was offered the opportunity to become the next Rush Limbaugh. All he had to do was stop talking about important things. They did the same thing to Jesse Ventura. In fact, it was interesting. It was just this last week when I was talking to a friend of mine. I won't use his name because I don't have his permission, but I've known him for many years. He's written on the same subjects that we do. And he'd written a book for Catholics. He's a very conservative Catholic. And he said that he was called in by Time, AOL, Time Warner, and they offered him $5 million for the rights to reproduce his book, with a proviso he would remove the information about the homosexuality and the moral breakdown from the book. And he said, well, there wasn't a hard choice to make. That was the very essence of the book. And he said he rejected their $5 million offer. And as I told him, oh, shucks, I haven't been given a similar offer. I hope I would have the integrity to do what you did. He rejected the offer. But I've interviewed a number of people who've died. They've killed them. I've interviewed assassins. We have a four-tape set, or four-CD set, available through my ministry called Deadly Assassins. And
oh,
there I interview two professional assassins. One of them is Chick Tatum. He was the man who was hired to kill or ordered to kill Ross Perot during the presidential campaign. He refused to do it, and he disappeared. He probably paid for it with his life, but we do have the interview with him. Another was Colonel Daniel Marvin, lieutenant colonel in the Special Forces, who was a trained assassin, trained in assassination. In fact, when he went to assassin school, the CIA there openly talked about how and why they killed President Kennedy. We have in that four-CD set an interview with a gentleman who tracked down the man who was paid to kill General Patton. Why did they want to kill General Patton? They couldn't let him come home here and tell the American people he could have entered the Second World War much sooner, but they cut off the oil so that he was ready to take his 2nd Armored Division and streak right across Germany and take Berlin. They didn't want to end the war. They wanted to prolong it as long as they could and kill as many Americans as they could and English and Germans as well. So they prolonged the war for another 6 months, and here we carry the book, A Target Patton. And, of course, we carry all sorts of things you're not going to get elsewhere. About how they kill people. We have a 4-tape set on the murder of Martin Luther King, and James Earl Ray didn't do it. And the King family never believed that James Earl Ray killed Martin Luther King. Certainly, we carry a 4-tape set on Bobby Kennedy's murder. And, of course, it goes to the fact that all of the evidence shows Saran didn't do it. Now, he was certainly there, but he was standing in front of Bobby Kennedy about 3 feet, firing wildly with a gun that held 8 bullets, yet there were 13 bullets in the room, and, of course, he was shot from behind, about an inch and a half away from behind. And, of course, this has never been brought out. We have a book on Bobby Kennedy. We have a BBC documentary that has never been allowed to be shown in the United States. They can't let the American people know that they actively kill people. We have a couple of 4-tape sets and a video on the murder of John Kennedy. There's no question this was a CIA operation. It was carried out by the mafia. And just to show you, there's no honor in the world today. There's ideas of honor, because at least the mafia has a sense of honor. Sam Giancana was the guy who was responsible, who arranged for the murder of Kennedy at the behest of the CIA. And the CIA went around and turned around and killed Sam Giancana. There's just no honor in the world today. In fact, if you want to verify that, although we don't carry the book, you can get it on Amazon. It's a book called Double Cross. It's written by Sam's brother, Chuck Giancana, wrote the book about how they double-crossed Sam Giancana, and after he had arranged for the murder of world leaders like Diem and Ngo and Patrice Lumumba and Trujillo and John Kennedy, how after he had done this for the CIA and they, of course, provided the drugs for his enterprises, then the CIA turned around and killed Sam Giancana. The book, Double Cross by Chuck Giancana, and so much information that we've talked about, most of it's available from Radio Liberty. We don't carry that book, Double Cross, but it's readily available from Amazon. So we do hope your listeners will check out the facts, get our material, and get all the information we have. Talk to people, understand reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king, because they control the media and they control our reality.
Quite right, and just so. And Dr. Monteith, I think the foremost reason why it's such a privilege for me to have you join our program today is your ability to quote and offer these very specific examples, not just these examples from the course of history, but then also the trail of research, so to speak, the breadcrumbs where our listeners can pick up that trail and conduct more extensive research for themselves as well. And one of the names that you mentioned earlier in the program here is Jesse Ventura, how he was also made the offer, the deal with the devil, so to speak. And I like that in his most recent release himself, 63 documents the government doesn't want you to read, folks in the listening audience, several of these exact programs and operations that Dr. Monteith has discussed thus far, you can hold the documents for some of these programs. And keep in mind, folks, we're talking about large segments of organized groups of people funded by your taxpayers' dollars. Well, no, actually, that's not quite true, because all of the dollars that are funding them nowadays are borrowed. So they're not even your taxpayer dollars. They are the taxpayer dollars of your children and your children's children and grandchildren. That's what's funding these heinous operations. And Dr. Monteith, among your comments thus far, I think there's only one point that I would take umbrance with or disagreement in, and that is that your statement that there's no honor in the world. I believe that there still is. I believe that there, however, is no honor among thieves. And that's who we're represented
right. by. I won't quibble with you over that. Yes, I do believe they're honorable people. I believe Jesse Ventura and Alex Jones, and Cindy, my friend, who turned down the $5 million from Time Warner, Daniel Estulin, there are men with honor. They're men of honor and integrity. In fact, most people are good people. I mean, there's only a small number of people on the other side. They're just very well organized, and I believe they have a little supernatural help that comes from the very pit of hell. But
they have also some extraordinary
Jesse Ventura's book, 63 documents the government doesn't want you to read. That's 63 documents the government doesn't want you to read by Jesse Ventura. It's available, but 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927 or 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's the number we use when I was writing extensively about the AIDS epidemic and the fact that we've never really tried to stop the spread of that epidemic.
Quite right, quite right. Now, Dr. Monteith, I want to make sure that we begin to connect some of the dots for the listening audience. I can already sense in my mind's eye that many people listening, cognitive dissonance has begun to kick in. Cognitive dissonance, when you're hearing information that is new to you and when it is so radically unique or apart from what your existing paradigm is, the mind wants to try to partition that. It wants to try to get rid of that so that it doesn't have to deal with it. But we're not going to allow cognitive dissonance to be a factor for our audience. We want to connect some dots. It is chilling enough to learn about the assassinations and exterminations that are made on the small scale. But as we began our program and talked about the Georgia Guidestones, we understand that there is a very large plan in place that wants to take the world's population from its current state of over 6 billion to fewer than 1 billion, and in fact to maintain it at 500 million or below, as you discussed. And I want to try to connect some of these dots with specific examples of how they've already been conducting this work. They've laid the groundstones for decades now. I wonder if we might begin with the Tuskegee experiments. Could you help our listening audience know more about what occurred there? And we might just follow a trail of a few more examples like that to see how
Tuskegee is certainly one of the more glaring ones, but small, minuscule in scale. But basically back in 1931, why a group of public health officials recruited about 400 black men with syphilis. And the idea was they wanted to see what would happen to the black men, how syphilis would ravage their bodies and kill them. And the purpose was to autopsy them. They wanted to cut open their bodies and study their organs. Now, in 1931, there was no effective treatment for syphilis. They gave mercury shots, arsenicals, but a very, very questionable value. By 1941, we had penicillin, and penicillin was an excellent treatment for syphilis. So suddenly they could justify recruiting these men in 1931 into this experiment. But by 1941, these men should have been treated. The program should have been discontinued. But instead of that, they had an organized effort to withhold treatment from these men, to make them think they were being treated, to lie to them and to their families so they could kill them, so they could autopsy their bodies after they died. That was the stated purpose. That was the goal. They wrote about it in medical journals. And when the men certainly moved to other areas, they did everything they could to block them from getting treated there. And this continued from 1931 until 1971. And it was at that time, and you see, doctors all across America knew about this. Every public health official knew about it because it was written up repeatedly in the scientific journals. But there was a law student, a pre-law student, and we actually have a four-tape set on Tuskegee where we interview that law student, and he's come to be a friend of ours. And actually, he was working in the public health department in San Francisco, waiting to get his opportunity to go to law school. Whereupon he heard them talking in the lunchroom about this experiment. He got some of the literature. He found out what they were doing. They were plotting to kill the 400 black men. And, of course, probably a number of them, probably most of them had died by this time. Remember, the experiment had been running for 40 years at this time. And so he wrote a letter to the Centers for Disease Control and said, what you're doing is immoral. You don't have the right to kill these men. There's effective treatments for syphilis. And he got back an indignant letter from the head of the CDC, who said, you know, who are you to question us? And then, of course, the CDC got together a group of medical experts, and there was only one of them who said, you know, this is wrong, this is morally wrong. But all the rest of them, of course, worked for the government in one branch or another. And when you work for the government, you go along, and if it means killing people, you kill them. So here this frustrated law student, he doesn't know what to do, and he talks to people in San Francisco. Nobody will pick up the story. He meets a woman who's a reporter for the New York Times. He tells her the story, and they sense what a wonderful story it is. They run it on page one of the New York Times, and suddenly everybody in Washington, D.C. is horrified. Why, we would never do anything like that. We had no idea what was going on. Imagine that. And they all lied. Well, eventually, of course, they bribed the lawyers who were hired by the families of the men who died, and they got a pittance of money. And I think one person was fired as a result of it, and that made up for it. They'd killed, murdered well over 300 black men. But, of course, it was because they were black, and black lives were not that important in those days, and they're still not. There is a conspiracy against the blacks today, and we could talk about how that really is operating. I mean, they're conspiring to kill off the majority of black people in our nation and throughout the world today. And so I could just, first of all, we have a wonderful four-tape set on the Tuskegee study. It's the best thing available. It's 2 hours with the law student who broke the case, and 2 hours with the historian who wrote the classic book on the Tuskegee study, and in many respects, he sort of sympathized with this, although he was honest and objective, and I have the greatest respect for him. He did a wonderful job on his book, Tuskegee. But we spent 2 hours with him and 2 hours with the author of the law student who broke the case. And of course, they went after him. They blocked him from ever being able to get a license to practice law, because when you do something like that, you are severely punished. That is, if you're allowed to live. But anyway, of course, do you want to talk about the other things they're doing to blacks today to get rid of them in large numbers?
Well, yes, I would, but maybe first, just by way of recapping, I'd like to, I so much appreciate the depth of the experience that you bring, even to this first example, the Tuskegee experiments. But folks in the listening audience, please realize, you're talking about a program that was conducted, as Dr. Monti said, between 1932 and 1972. It went on for
1931 and 1971, but that's okay, it doesn't matter.
Sure, four decades. The 400 participants were recruited by the U.S. Public Health Service. That's right, the U.S. Public Health Service, funded by your taxpayer dollars. And it had to have involved, Dr. Monteith, I'm not sure if you have a sense of the scope of exactly how many people were, quote-unquote, the insiders that it required to conduct this, how many doctors and nurses, and then, of course, the folks from the U.S. Public Health Service, but in the span of four decades, I'm assuming we're talking at least hundreds of people who were in the know.
Thousands of people knew about it. It was published in the medical journals. It was published in the public health journals. I mean, literally everybody in the U.S. Public Health Service knew about it, and were told, if these men come into your... we want to be able to autopsy them. Cut them up. Cut them open, look at their brains, look at their hearts. I mean, what sort of human beings would do that? Some of the people who work here at the highest levels of our own government. Go ahead.
Dr. Monteith, I hope you'll bear with me a moment. I'm having some audio troubles on my end.
Sure, go right ahead.
Perhaps if you...
you discuss in your paper on population control, DDT is another example, as well as abortion, breast carcinoma, and population control. Maybe you could speak to those topics for a moment.
Well, certainly abortion is pretty well straightforward as far as we've killed about 50 million children. They haven't been born here in the United States. The figure is about 400 million in China, and similar numbers in other major countries throughout the world. But it's far more than abortion. What they're doing, of course, is working to poison fertility. Throughout the world, the incidence of pregnancy and children in a family has dropped from about 6.6 children per family down to about 2.6 children per family. In other words, families are only about half as large as they used to be. Why is that? Why, they poison fertility. And they've done that simply by, if all throughout the world, the male sperm count has fallen about 50%, and the sperm are not as healthy as they used to be. Nobody ever asked why. Well, the officials acknowledge that the male sperm count has fallen throughout the world, but they just can't figure out why. Well, they're lying. They know why, because we get into that in great detail if you want to. The way, for instance, they're poised, they know why. If you have a cell phone, you carry it in your pocket, your sperm will be wimpy. They will not be readily available to actually impregnate a woman and create a life, because they've damaged the sperm with cell phones. But they do this with certainly aspartame. Aspartame is a deadly poison. It's included in all of our food. It's known as NutraSweet. It's in our chewing gum. It's in our products we have. It's in our vaccines. It's in childhood products. It's added to most of the foods that you eat. Oh, look and see, going right along with MSG. These are deadly poisons. They're excitotoxins. They kill nerve cells. Aspartame produces pathological obesity. It produces diabetes. It interferes with pregnancy. It produces mental aberrations, abnormalities, and certainly attention deficit disorders. It produces convulsions. It interferes with the endocrine system. It attacks the heart. It attacks the entire body. It breaks down into methanol and formaldehyde. And yet it's in all of our products. They know it's a deadly poison. The FDA blocked it for 15 years, knowing it was a poison. It was introduced into the food chain in 1980 during the Reagan transition team, when a man named Donald Rumsfeld was appointed to look after the FDA. He headed Cereal. They wanted to get aspartame legalized, and they did. And then they put their man into the FDA. He authorized it, and then he retired. He got a job with $1,000 a day for the rest of his life, working for the publicity department that worked for Cereal. And ever since then, why, of course, they've been putting this product in our food. Betty Martini has spent 20 years fighting this, and she's a frequent guest on our program. She asked one of the high government officials one time, why are you doing this? He says it's all about population control. There are too many people in the world. But aspartame is just one of the things they do to destroy the male sperm count. Every one of our cans, if you buy canned goods, why, the cans are lined with something called bisphenol. And you find it in your plastics, your hard plastics. Baby bottles contain it. You heat up the baby bottle. And, of course, the bisphenol comes out of the plastic and gets in the milk. And it feminizes. It's an estrogen. So it feminizes our boys. And this is why I think some boys have female lack of identity. They know how deadly bisphenol is as far as reproduction. You go into the color, artificial coloring in food. The cosmetics that we use, the insecticides we use. They did away with the safest of all insecticides, that was DDT, and they substituted deadly insecticides like atrazine and many of the others that have a devastating effect on the health of the people. They know full well that if you drink milk as an adult more than 16 ounces a day, your incidence of breast and prostate cancer triples. I mean, the scientific studies are there. You're never going to hear this on television. Certainly, they're having us eat soy. Soy tends to feminize men because there's a strong estrogenic component in soy products. We have soy milk. We have soy meal. We have soy products, and they feed them to the cattle, and then we eat them, and we get these high doses of estrogen, and then we wonder why the male sperm count is down. Everything I'm saying is, of course, soy is also carcinogenic, and we can go right on down the line of the genetically modified foods that alter fertility. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the American people to know. And Chris,
Quite right.
I mean, we're just touching the very periphery of what's going on today. But we are under attack today. And basically, they have killed already at least 1.5 billion people. The people who've not only been aborted, the people who haven't been born, because, of course, they encourage the sterilization of women. As a physician, I can tell you, they take out the uterus or the ovaries or the fallopian tubes. And doctors are told that they should be doing this, and they go right along without realizing they are being used as part of this population control agenda. And basically, if you look and see, they are sterilizing people. In fact, in some countries of the world, like India, they rounded up the men and they sterilize them. In other countries, in Africa, why, of course, they'll put a well in your village if all the men are sterilized. Over there, where they have all sorts of diseases, why, of course, they've got plenty of contraceptives, but very little medicine to treat the people or keep them alive. And we spend countless billions of dollars every year, the United States, on the population control agenda. But one of the biggest things that is being used to control population is vaccination. What's the relationship between vaccination and population control? Well, it's epigenetics. And I dare say now one person in 1,000 in your listening audience has ever heard of epigenetics, E-P-I-G-E-N-E-T-I-C-S. But epigenetics is the vehicle by which you alter the genetic makeup of the individual. We are our genes. And basically a gene is a little molecule, and it's like a switch. You can turn it off or you can turn it on. You turn it on, it produces other molecules. You turn it off, it stops producing molecules, and we have fertility genes. And what the mercury in vaccines does, that's thimerosal, it actually turns off the fertility gene. So that, you know, if you have got your mercury shots, why, chances are your fertility genes are not working properly. But even if you do have children, this goes from generation to generation, because if your fertility gene is turned off in your body, why, it'll be turned off in your sperm or your ovum, and your children's fertility gene will be turned off. And if they have any children, why, of course, which is unlikely, but if they do, why, their fertility genes are turned off. It's called epigenetics. And this is why Bill Gates, who's totally dedicated to population control, is pushing vaccination throughout the world today. But
quite right, quite right. And in fact, at 50 minutes after the hour, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to BBSRadio.com and The Crimson Pill with your host, Antonin Fiore. It is our distinct privilege to be joined today by Dr. Stanley Monteith. And Dr. Monteith, on the heels of your most recent comments, what I find to be extremely advantageous for our listening audience is the fact that you speak to these points yourself with a medical background. You are a doctor of medicine. You've spent your career in the field. You've read the literature. You walk and speak in the circles of people who are very knowledgeable on these subjects, also with a background in the field of medicine. And so it's with a voice of authority that you speak to these subjects, and that's why it's such an honor for us to have you with us. Now, Dr. Monteith, the course of our conversation, I'm sure, could run for 6 hours if either of us had the available time, and I want to be very respectful and mindful of yours. As we're approaching the top of the hour, if it would be possible for you to join us on into the second hour, we could take a bit of a break and pick up the thread of our conversation. I'll make that offer to you, and then maybe give you the chance to consider that as I ask you to maybe share with us your thoughts at this moment about either the topics we've already covered or some additional connecting points you'd like to bring.
Well, I could stay with you perhaps half an hour if you'd like, but basically for your listeners who would like to verify what I just said about epigenetics.
Yes, epigenetics, right?
The source of information is a talk given by Dr. David Ayoub, A-Y-O-U-B, and we actually offered on a DVD called Mercury Autism and the Global Vaccine Agenda. Mercury Autism and the Global Vaccine Agenda. But if you get the DVD, you get a free CD-ROM that has several thousand pages of scientific papers going into the background of how mercury in vaccines is harmful, and they know it is harmful. They just don't want you to know it, and they've concealed the truth from the American people. But we also carry in our ministry something called the Simpson-Wood Report. And the Simpson-Wood Report was a secret, the minutes of a secret meeting held by the Centers for Disease Control in the year 2000, where they had the high officials from the CDC and the Public Health Service and the vaccine manufacturers. And they wanted to evaluate the danger of mercury in vaccines. And they came to the conclusion that mercury in vaccines was harmful. And what were they going to do? How were they going to keep the American people from learning the truth? And that was the tragedy. That's what it was all about. How do we keep the American people from learning the truth? And we actually carry the Simpson-Wood Report, and you can purchase it through my ministry by calling 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, or go up on the Internet and you can pull it down and print it out yourself if you want to. We make it available because some people don't have computers and some people don't want to spend all the money to print it out and then bind it. And so we presented it nicely bound. The Simpson-Wood Report, the top secret CDC report that they wanted to conceal from the American people. They did for many years. Unfortunately, Congressman Weldon was able to get it released, and it is available through my ministry, the Simpson-Wood Report. Read it and weep. For as one of the high government officials said, well, my grandchild was just born last night, and he's not going to take any of the mercury in his vaccines. But, of course, he was quite willing to conceal that from the rest of the American people. These are people without honor. These are people without integrity. They have an agenda. It's called population control. And, of course, they have already killed several billion people.
Quite right, and just so. And, Dr. Monteith, as you alluded to earlier, everything that we've talked about thus far really merely is the tip of the iceberg. And as chilling as it is to be on the tip of the iceberg, it's outright below freezing as you explore what lies below the surface of the water, and that's where I'd like us to continue our conversation. I can imagine that several of our listeners now, due to the effects of cognitive dissonance, are wondering, how is it possible that the United States of America, old red, white, and blue, could possibly be involved in these sort of things? And yet, folks, we've shown you already the Tuskegee experiments, as well as programs like MKUltra, Project Artichoke, some of the experiments that we know that they were conducting on our own military personnel pertaining to effects of radiation, as well as other pathogenic effects and research that were done without their knowledge, without their approval. And yes, they have the license to conduct all ranges of experimentation on us without our knowledge or approval. Perhaps we can turn to that. And some of you are wondering, well, how could it be possible that our Congress, that our president, that our military could be involved in these sorts of nefarious, in fact, heinous activities? Well, I'll tell you. Many of them are engaged in this because they think that they're operating on a higher authority. In point of fact, in just the past few months, we've seen a constitutional violation of the use of war powers. And the claim? Because they're fulfilling the directives of the United Nations. They claim their authority to commit our troops, our citizens, to action on the directives of the United Nations. Well, members of the listening audience, we'll talk a bit more about what is known as United Nations Agenda 21 and how that fits hand in glove with the population control agenda that Dr. Stanley Monteith has been so gracious to afford us his time to discuss. Dr. Monteith, with your permission, sir, we'll take a short break. We'll continue our conversation in about 4 to 5 minutes, following along with this thread. If that's okay with you, we'll go into overtime with your
right,
knowledge.
All right, fine. We'll have to quit in about half an hour because I'm wearing down, but we'll go ahead another 30 minutes. And but remember, we have a visible government. We have an invisible government. I love my government. I fear the invisible government because it's made up of evil and wicked people. I'll stick with you for 30 minutes.
Thank you so much, my friend. I certainly appreciate it, and I fully agree. Folks, we'll be back in just a few minutes to continue our discussion with Dr. Stanley Monteith.
Creator and sustainer of all the worlds, whether those worlds are known or unknown to mankind. Creator and sustainer of all the worlds. Of all the worlds. Worlds, 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 worlds. Creator and sustainer of all the worlds, whether those worlds are known or unknown to mankind.
And ladies and gentlemen of the BBSRadio.com listening audience, welcome back to our continued discussion with Dr. Stanley Monteith, one of the preeminent voices in the field of the research of what's really going on around here anyway, as well as one of the leading authorities with some of these issues that we've dealt with thus far that touch upon the medical aspects, the diseases, the pathogens, the controlled agenda as pertains to population control. And Dr. Monteith, once again, I feel, my friend, that we could sit and visit for hours on end and still barely scratch the surface of so many of these topics that are relevant and essential for us to become more informed on. And yet I wonder if we could turn our attention now to some of the current events, so to speak, some of the geopolitical machinations around the world. Of course, the United States military is at this moment committed to multiple theaters of operation and activity, and I wonder if you might help our listening audience understand a bit more as to some of the underpinnings to these unprecedented events, operations, and headlines that we're seeing.
All right. Well, I think, first of all, I want to preface what I say by saying that we have a visible government, we have an invisible government. We have the government we elect, congressmen, senators, president, we have our court system, a legislative, judicial, executive. Then we have an invisible government, and they're the ones who run it all. And, of course, the visible government is simply a front. I mean, the congressmen get up, and they pound the podium, and they shout, and they point, but it's all political theater. They have no influence at all. They could have influence, but they don't. Because most of them are bought and purchased by the people of great wealth. We have the finest congressmen and senators money can buy. So with that, and then we have, of course, this invisible government. Basically, they control the military, the top military leaders. You don't get to be a four-star general under most circumstances unless you're willing to compromise everything and sell your soul. I say, yes, sirree, I'll do whatever I'm told. And if I'm told to take my men off to fight in another no-win war, that's all right. I want to keep my pension. I want another star. And then, of course, we have the control over banking and, of course, over business and over our corporations. Why? Because we have a small group of people who have learned the secret of fractional reserve banking, how to make money out of nothing. And so because they can create money, and they do, that's what it's really not money, it's credit, but they've used it to buy up the banks and to buy up the corporations and to buy up the politicians and to buy off the professors. And so they control the great tax-exempt foundation. That is the invisible government. They work through what I call the Council on Foreign Relations, but you need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. I mean, they work through a number of organizations, secret societies, some of them like Skull and Bones. Well, everybody says, well, you can read about Skull and Bones, yes, but you're never going to see the secret initiation ceremony unless you go to the website put up by a friend of mine, William H. Kennedy, and you can actually see the secret ceremony there at Skull and Bones, where they kneel before a replica of Lucifer. And that, of course, is the Bohemian Grove. Does everybody at the Bohemian Grove know it is a satanic organization? Certainly not. But the presidents and the secretaries of state and the leaders of our corporations, many of them run around naked in the woods and, of course, having sexual relations with children or women forced into prostitution. And we have a wonderful four-tape set on the Bohemian Grove. One of the guests is a woman named Kathy O'Brien.
Ah, yes.
Forced into prostitution there at the Bohemian Grove. In fact, she has extensive sessions about Senator Robert Byrd and about Dick Cheney. In her books, we carry them, Transformation of America and access denied. Is this her testimony before the House of Representatives or the Senate? I can't remember which one it was. She gave extensive testimony, and it was immediately marked top secret and was never to be revealed, but they'd already put it in book form. That's access denied. But, of course, I said Richard Nixon listened to the White House tapes. Richard Nixon went to the Bohemian Grove. He didn't like it. He talks about all those fags there at the Bohemian Grove and running around naked, but he wanted to be associated with the important people. After all, he was just the President of the United States. He wanted to be around the people who ran our country. And so Richard Nixon, even though he didn't like it, went to the meetings. David Gershom, who a White House counsel for Bill Clinton, he wrote about it and how he eventually resigned from the organization because he was so disgusted with it. But if you've ever seen, there's a film, it's called Eyes Wide Shut.
Yes.
It was put out by a man named Stanley Kubrick. And of course, it shows the world leaders with their hoods and with their robes and with their candles. Stanley Kubrick died before the film was ever released. It stars Tom Hanks, Eyes Wide Shut. You should get it and watch it. And then watch Alex Jones' video, which you can get through my ministry, Alex Jones' video, the Bohemian Grove, and you see the leaders of the world with their hoods and their capes and their candles, standing before a replica of a gigantic owl. Now, who does the owl represent? Well, we have their secret writings. I think we have the only copies of their secret books. We were able to get them from a used bookstore. Somebody has sold them. And on the fly page, it says, "We revere the owl." We revere the owl. And they have this feigned human sacrifice in front of the owl. Each time, the owl is a replica of Moloch, of Satan, of evil. And yet here are our leaders of our country bowing before the replica of Moloch, the owl. And in their own publications, they say, "We revere the owl." We actually have that. And I don't know anybody else has even ever mentioned it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we could go into all the other secret societies, the Rosicrucians, the Lucius Society, it's the Osiphus, and so many more out there. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Read about the family. Read about the Opus Dei. Read about certainly the Ascended Masters and the spiritual hierarchy and the occult hierarchy and the order. And they're all there in that or in our subsequent writings. Understand, it's not imaginary, they're real. There are dozens of secret and semi-secret organizations, all that are bound together by a common goal, the effort to bring about a one-world government, the effort to bring about a one-world financial system and a one-world currency, and a one-world religion to destroy Christianity and install the world leader. Now, I would point out for our listeners that they are in the process of destroying the value of our currency and impoverishing our people. Are they doing that intentionally and purposely? Ben Bernanke says there is no inflation. I mean, core inflation is only 1.5%, maybe 2%. Well, but they define what core inflation is. Look at the price of food. Look at the price of gasoline. Look at the price of imported goods. And they say, that's not inflation. Core inflation is what we say it is. Are you going to believe your lying eyes? Are you going to believe us? We're from the government. We're here to help you. And we wouldn't lie to you, would we? And the answer is, of course they're lying to us. They're in the process of destroying our inflation so they can impoverish our people, so they can impose this ruthless tyranny and kill off most of the people in our society, those who are allowed to live. And basically, this is not imaginary. You read their writings, they openly talk about that. In fact, as George Bernard Shaw says in his book, The Impact of, pardon me, uh, the... Um, An Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism and Capitalism on the last page. You know, under socialism, nobody's described it, but let me describe it for you. Under socialism, you'd be forcibly fed, housed, and clothed, whether you liked it or not. And if ever found that you were unworthy of our efforts, it might be necessary to put you to death in a kindly fashion. But while you were allowed to live, you would have to live well. That's what it's all about. And they think nothing at all about killing billions of people because they have a different worldview, because they worship a different God. Well, with that as the background, the fact that they are intentionally inflating away the value of our currency, and they're intentionally sending our jobs overseas. I mean, people wait for the jobs to come back. They're not coming back. They've been sent overseas intentionally. We've outsourced our jobs. We've outsourced our factories or offshored our factories. We've sent our wealth overseas. We've destroyed the value of our currency. You know, very often you'll call an answering service. You get somebody on the other end of the line who sounds like their name is Raj and they're in New Delhi, and that's because you're talking to Raj in New Delhi. He may call himself Tom, but his real name is Raj.
I think maybe one of the reasons that the attempt was made on Ross Perot's life is because of his prophecy of the giant sucking sound to the south. But the only thing he was wrong is that it was also a giant sucking sound to the east at the same time.
Absolutely. The whole idea is to send our jobs to Mexico, to Brazil, to Russia, to China, and to the so-called BRIC nations. They know exactly what they're doing. They just, India, they don't want the American people to know. Right now, most of our engineering is being done in India for a third the price. Most of our architectural design is being done there. A great deal of our legal work, a lot of our medical work. They could read our CT scans and MRIs and X-rays over there at a fraction of what they can read them here. And by the miracle of electronics, get the report back. The doctor can see it in probably a few minutes. They've got doctors over there who work for a pittance who are happy to read the X-rays and the CT scans and the MRIs. But they're in the process of destroying our industries. In fact, I was just reading an article, in the Wall Street Journal. It was talking about all the jobs coming back in Florida from overseas. In fact, there were between 6 and 8 jobs that returned from China to Florida. Eight jobs. I kept looking, is that 600 or 800? Is it 6 to 8,000? Is it 60 to 80,000? No, it was 6 to 8 jobs. Isn't it wonderful? Jobs are coming back from China, but more are going over all the time. They've intentionally sent our jobs overseas because they want to lower our living standards and impoverish our people. Well, let's quickly touch on what's going on in the Middle East, because you have to understand this is all planned, and we know it's planned. How do we know it's planned? Well, first of all, we know because in mid-October, and, I'm really so fortunate to sometimes be on the front lines of things, and why me? Sometimes I ask, but be that as it may, in mid-October, a friend of mine named Lindsay Williams called and told me that he had just talked to his informant within the hierarchy. That was a man named Ken Fromm, who had been the CEO of ARCO when he retired and was a member of the hierarchy. He wasn't all the way at the top, but he was pretty high up in this invisible government, Brotherhood of Darkness. But Ken was dying at this time. He subsequently has died. So in mid-October of last year, 2010, Lindsay called him, Ken Fromm, told Lindsay that within 4 to 6 months, there would be a major conflict in the Middle East. Now, Lindsay had called Ken Fromm because I had asked Lindsay to call and find out if there's going to be a war with Iran. I thought that all the things I'm hearing, sounds like there's going to be a war with Iran, but I figured that maybe they were feeding me faulty information, which they were, of course. And all the people who were supposedly my informants giving me this information from inside were lying. And Fromm said, and he laughed at Lindsay. He says, Lindsay, there's not going to be a war with Syria now, pardon me, with Iran now. But there's going to be a conflict in the Middle East in 4 to 6 months. And Lindsey kept trying to get him to say what the conflict was, and Ken wouldn't tell him. But he says the price of oil's going to go up, and there's going to be a conflict in 4 to 6 months. Well, then it was the first of the following month. Yeah, that was in November last year, 2010, where, and basically, if you want to verify what I said about Lindsey's story, I did some interviews with Lindsey the 1st of November, and he put this out on my program, all of my programs. So we got our people thinking along this line, although we didn't know what the conflict was going to be. Now then, on the 1st of November, about 10 o'clock in the evening at the House of Lords in London, at the Parliament building, a man named Lord James got up, and he was giving a dissertation. I guess everybody was getting late. It was 10 o'clock at night. We have the minutes from the Parliament, or you can check this out. If you have a computer, simply go up and put into your search engine, and you may have to go to Yahoo. They may have taken it off of Google, because Google works very closely with what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness, but it may be back up. You have to go and see. But type in Lord James, J-A-M-E-S, Lord James, Belfast Telegraph, funding terrorism. And here's the story. Lord James is up there, and he's talking along, and somebody, one of the other lords, gets up and says, why would anybody come to you with information? You know, you're not that important. And Lord James, you know, being egotistical, he says, well, of course I'm important. Whether you know it or not, I have funded billions of pounds to the terrorists in Ireland and in North Africa. I funded billions of pounds to the terrorists in Ireland. Remember, they're the ones that are killing the British people, but it's all agent provocateur. They staged this whole thing so the people rally behind the British government because they got the enemy over in Ireland. It was actually funded by the British intelligence and the Bank of England. And then Lord James goes on to say, so I've been funding billions of pounds, was the term, to the terrorists in Ireland and in North Africa, but I can't talk about South Africa. It's an ongoing process, and it's very sensitive at this time.
Very sensitive.
And then he goes on to say, but don't call the police on me. I'm carrying this out for the Bank of England. I'm working for them. I'm doing what they tell me to do.
Just following
now,
orders,
not a
right?
word of this in the American press. Not one word in the controlled media. And it didn't even get out very well in England, but we do have the minutes from the House of Lords. We have the article at the Belfast Telegraph, which is an Irish publication, but they can't let the English people know that they're funding the Irish Republican Army that's killing people in England, and everybody thinks it's some independent organization. No, this is how the world really works. You hire the enemy, you have them kill your own people, and then the people rally behind the English government to protect them from the evil Irish Republican Army that's controlled by the British intelligence services. So anyway, this is the 1st of November. Lord James gets up and spills the beans. Well, then about the middle of December, we start with the revolution in Tunisia, followed by the revolution in Egypt, followed by the overthrow of the Lebanese government. And, of course, the Turkish government is already under the auspices of the CIA, has moved out of its alliance with the West, and is moving into the radical Islamic camp. And then we have our riots in Algeria and Morocco and Jordan and Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and even some riots in Iraq. And this whole, and then Syria, and then we have the revolution in Libya. It's all funded by our intelligence agencies. There's only about 1,000 rebels in Libya. Gaddafi's very popular in Libya. In fact, he's even armed his own people to protect them. He wouldn't arm his people if he was afraid of them. And the people there are solidly behind Gaddafi. Why? Because he's given a great deal of money to the people. Their standard of living is high. They've had security. Is he a nice man? Of course not. No dictator is a nice man. but he's got a lot of support from the people. And the same thing is true in Syria. You see these pictures in the paper of the mass demonstrations in Syria, and they tell you all these people demonstrating against Assad. Actually, those are people demonstrating in favor of Assad. But, of course, when you look at the newspaper, you see all the people there, and then they tell you they're demonstrating against Assad. You don't know what's really going on. So, basically, the United States and our allies are behind the revolution in Libya because we want to topple Libya. We've already toppled both Egypt and Tunisia. We're in the process of toppling the government in Syria. And we are going to destabilize all of the governments in that area of the world, the Near East, the Middle East. And, of course, what will replace them? Well, the only thing that there is there to replace them is this radical form of Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood. What is the Muslim Brotherhood? We'll go up and read about it. Fortunately, we have the Internet. You can find the information, but you have to know who you can trust, because our intelligence agencies, the Brotherhood of Darkness, is putting up all sorts of faulty information on the Internet. Why? To confuse you. But I will tell you who is behind the Muslim Brotherhood. Why, your tax dollars, ladies and gentlemen, your tax dollars. The CIA has funded the Muslim Brotherhood since 1952. It was organized initially, this radical Islamic group, in 1928. At that time, it was funded by MI6, British Intelligence. And after the Second World War, of course, Great Britain was bankrupt. And, of course, then, of course, they transferred control of so much of this to the CIA. But the CIA and MI6 worked together. In fact, our country is run by the Council on Foreign Relations, located at 68th Street in New York City. That's the Council on Foreign Relations, located at the Harold Pratt House at 68th Street in New York City. Great Britain is run not from Buckingham Palace or the Parliament. It's run from number 10, St. James Square, which is just off of Trafalgar Square in London. That is, of course, Chatham House, the Royal Institute for International Affairs. And the Royal Institute was established in 1919. The CFR was established in 1921. And both of them are fronts for the secret society that Cecil Rhodes created in 1891 to take over control of the world. And Cecil Rhodes openly wrote that it would be 100 years before his dream came to pass. But it would come to pass because he established the Rhodes Scholarships to train people in this radical form of government under the control of a ruling elite. He had the money, of course, to buy up the media, and they remained under control since then. And the disciples of Cecil Rhodes' secret society dominate the Royal Institute for International Affairs and the Council on Foreign Relations today. And, of course, the CFR was outed in 1972 by Gary Allen in a little book called None Dare Call It Conspiracy. I think Gary put out either 7 or 10 million copies of the book. Go to your local bookstore and try to buy a copy, one of the used copies. They bought them up and shredded them. They're still available. We offer them through my ministry, but every copy they can get their hands on, they shred. Why? The last thing they want is for the American people to understand that the electoral process is totally fallacious. We have the finest politicians that money could buy, and even if you mean well and you go back to Washington, D.C., and you like being a congressman, you'll be a one-term congressman if you don't go along with the agenda. Because they'll run somebody in the primary, and they'll run all sorts of stories to embarrass you in your local district, or they'll get some woman to try to seduce you, or they'll find something on your family and something to discredit you. And if they can't, then they'll make up a story like they did with this poor guy, the head of the IMF. They wanted to get him out. I mean, here's the head of the International Monetary Fund, a fellow named Daniela, I think, Suzman Kuntz or something, or Sutzman Kuntz. And of course, he's arrested for trying to molest a black maid, you know, in a hotel room in New York City. Here's a guy with millions of dollars at his disposal. He can get a prostitute every place, and you mean he's chasing a black woman down the halls in his hotel so he can have sex with her? Do you really believe this story? Oh, they simply come up with a story, and how do you counter it when they've got a woman who said, he tried to attack me sexually? That's how you get rid of somebody, even the head of the International Monetary Fund.
It's almost as far-fetched as asking us to believe that Osama bin Laden has in fact been killed and brought back to life more often than Democratic voters in Chicago.
Absolutely. In fact, the greatest story of all is the 19 hijackers that attacked the World Trade Center. But
yes,
six of them are still alive. They died,
yes,
and then they brought them back to life, and they're alive and living and well in the Middle East. The government's never denied it. They just ignore it. Go to your internet search engine and type in six of the 19 hijackers died September 11th, living and well in the Middle East. Something like that. And you'll find many stories about the six hijackers who came back to life after September 11th. I mean, basically, it's like the story that they told us they recently killed Osama bin Laden, but they won't tell us who really did the killing. They won't show us any pictures. Isn't it interesting? They won't tell us anything, but they want us to believe them.
Oh, naturally. And not the least of which are the magic indestructible passports that somehow made it from the planes impacting the towers down to ground level, whereas everything else was reduced to rubble and fire. That's incredible.
Not only that, at the Twin Towers, but a similar thing happened at Shanksville. One of the hijackers' passports flooded to the ground there in Shanksville. There was no records of the plane, but the passport was there. Everything else was destroyed, but the passport in Shanksville and the passport there in New York City. Isn't that a coincidence?
Boy, we sure want to make sure we find out where the State Department gets that paper they print those passports on, right?
Anyway, Montes, I appreciate so much being with you, and I hope that, let me put on my website, it's RadioLiberty.com, that's RadioLiberty.com. My telephone number, 800-544-8927, 800-544-8927. People like to verify what we're saying, why they can, but go to our website. You can listen to our programs there, radio programs, live 4 hours a day, and you can listen to our archive programs there 24 hours a day. Get informed, and please, of course, tell others. And I want to say how pleased I am that we have a host like yours. People out there, young people, are going to be able to pick up and carry on when I'm not here. But more and more articulate young people are getting on the internet and find other means of getting the information out. And if I can share my information with them, then when I'm not here, they'll be able to continue sharing it with you.
Well, Dr. Monteith, there's no question in my mind that it is as a result of the work of conscious and spiritually and value-based individuals such as yourself, and also just plain ornery, because you don't give up. You have not given up, and you haven't flinched in the face of opposition and doubt. It is as a result of the work of yourself and folks like you that so many young people are awakening in the way that you've mentioned. And I wonder, sir, by way of our, sort of concluding our conversation, if I could throw out just a couple thoughts that I picked up from an article here and have your closing thoughts or reactions to this. This came from your humble host is a Prison Planet TV subscriber. That's Alex Jones's online presence. And I tune in live as often as I can, but when I can't, I'm scanning articles and always building my knowledge base. I'm going to quote from this following article, which actually was posted on Prison Planet. The title of the article is Al Gore, Agenda 21 and Population Control. And this was either posted or linked to by Prison Planet, the website that is called, and I'm not familiar with this, but endoftheamericandream.com. Is where this article, I believe, was originated from. I don't see the author's name. But what I'm about to read from or quote from is easily verifiable. I've already done the research on these quotes that I'm going to share. I'm going to read just two sentences from the story and then the quotes. The world is changing. The global elite have immense amounts of wealth and power, and they are intent on imposing a radical environmental agenda on all the rest of us. And that agenda is called Agenda 21, the United Nations Agenda 21. The reality is that many of the wealthiest and most prominent people in the world are absolutely obsessed with the green agenda and with population control. Just consider the following quotes. First, David Rockefeller. The negative impact of population growth on all of our planetary ecosystems is becoming appallingly evident. The negative impact of population growth. CNN founder Ted Turner. A total population of 250 to 300 million people. A 95% decline from present levels would be ideal. David Foreman, Earth First co-founder. My three main goals would be to reduce human population to about 100 million worldwide, destroy the industrial infrastructure, and see wilderness with its full complement of species returning throughout the world. Maurice Strong, who used to have a pretty important role in the United Nations on the environmental cause and movement, Maurice Strong, isn't the only hope for the planet that the industrialized civilizations collapse? Isn't it our responsibility to bring that about? Well, you know, I could continue reading, Dr. Monteith. You're well aware of some of these, but I wondered if that might pose for us an opportunity, again, for your closing comments and thoughts. And again, please knowing just truly how much we appreciate your time and the gracious acceptance of our invitation to be on the program.
Well, the quotation you just came up with from Maurice Strong comes from an article in West Magazine. We have copies of the original. Obviously, Ted Turner, a friend of mine, Deborah Tavares, went to a meeting that Ted Turner attended within the last month. We talked about the necessity of killing off or eliminating 95% of the population of the world. One of the richest men has said within the last month, we've got to kill off 95% of the world's population. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not imaginary. This is real. It's difficult to believe. But the process is underway. If you've never been to Elberton, Georgia, it's worth the trip, and you will become a believer, as I did, because I didn't want to believe this either. But there is evil in the world. There are evil men who worship a different God. We're involved in a spiritual battle that's being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, financial, educational and military battlefield, but it's a spiritual battle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. Today, evil is in control, but of course, in the background, standeth God, keeping watch of all the forces of his own. And ladies and gentlemen, I hope that people will read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and join us in this epic struggle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. God bless you. Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Likewise, and thank you so much, Dr. Monteith, for your work and for your time. And we certainly hope you all of the very best. We wish you strength and vitality in your continued research and work. And until the next time we meet again, we wish you safe travels.
God bless, and the same to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, it's 35 minutes after the hour. You're listening to BBSRadio.com and the Crimson Pill radio program with your host, Antonin Fiore. My goodness, your humble host has to take a deep breath, in part of which just to contemplate the extent of the agenda of the premeditated and calculated evil that has been planned, nurtured, hatched by so very few people in the world, and yet so few who control so very much. These aren't easy subjects to explore, ladies and gentlemen. If you remember Dr. Monteith's comments earlier in his conversation, these subjects not only are not easy to explore, they are terminal to explore for so many of the people who have committed their time and their efforts to the research of these topics. We're so very thankful that folks like Dr. Stanley Monteith have not met with that same end. At this time, I turn my attention back to the article that I quoted from near the end of our conversation. And once again, your humble host encountered this article posted on Prison Planet, actually technically Infowars.com, which is Alex Jones, one of his arms of information outreach. And the article actually originates from another website, the endoftheamericandream.com. There is no www preceding that. It is endoftheamericandream.com. The title of the article is Al Gore, Agenda 21 and Population Control. I'm going to continue reading from this article because of some of the additional information and quotes that are so germane to our conversation. John P. Holdren, Barack Obama's top science advisor, co-authored a textbook entitled Ecoscience, written back in 1977, in which he actually advocated mass sterilization, compulsory abortion, a one-world government, and a global police force to enforce population control. On page 837 of Ecoscience, a claim is made that compulsory abortion would be perfectly legal under the U.S. Constitution. I quote, "Indeed, it has been concluded that compulsory population control laws, even including laws requiring compulsory abortion, could be sustained under the existing Constitution if the population crisis becomes sufficiently severe to endanger the society." Then, on pages 942 and 943, a call is made for the creation of a quote-unquote planetary regime that would control the global economy and enforce population control measures. Again, I quote, "Perhaps those agencies, combined with UNEP, UNEP, and the United Nations population agencies, might eventually be developed into a planetary regime, sort of an international super agency for population, resources, and environment. Such a comprehensive planetary regime could control the development, administration, conservation, and distribution of all natural resources, renewable or non-renewable, at least insofar as international implications exist. Thus, the regime could have the power to control pollution not only in the atmosphere and oceans, but also in such freshwater bodies as rivers and lakes that cross international boundaries or that discharge into the oceans. The regime might also be a logical central agency for regulating all international trade, all international trade, perhaps including assistance from DCs to LDCs and including all food on the international market." Continuing the quote, "The planetary regime might be given responsibility for determining the optimum population for the world and for each region, and for arbitrating various countries' shares within their regional limits." Ladies and gentlemen, we're not talking about dollars. We're not talking about trade. Let me repeat that. "The planetary regime might be given responsibility for determining the optimum population for the world and for each region, and for arbitrating various countries' shares within their regional limits." They're talking about shares of you and your children. Each country given an allotment of population. I continue the quote, "Control of population size might remain the responsibility of each government, but the regime would have some power to enforce the agreed limits." On page 917, "The surrender of U.S. national sovereignty to an international organization is advocated." Beginning the quote, "If this could be accomplished, security might be provided by an armed international organization, a global analog of a police force. Many people have recognized this as a goal, but the way to reach it remains obscure in a world where factionalism seems, if anything, to be increasing. The first step necessarily involves partial surrender of sovereignty to an international organization." Now, as we mentioned earlier, Holdren, John P. Holdren, is the number one science advisor to current President Barack Obama. And the truth is that the top levels of the U.S. government are packed with people that believe just this sort of bunk. Now, cognitive dissonance, our old friend, I hear it shouting in my mind's eye, so many of you not willing to entertain the notions, perhaps unable to entertain the notions, that your government not only does not always have your best interests at heart, but quite frankly, let's think back to the Tuskegee experiments, a sequence of medical experimentation conducted over the course of more than four decades, involving people who consider themselves dedicated to their career path, their craft, their vocation of medicine, in which they are asked to take what is called the Hippocratic Oath and to conduct that sort of research, absolutely annihilating the essential elements of that oath, also conducted by representatives of the United States government. All of this work, all of the experimentation paid for with your taxpayer dollars. The participants in the experiment not only uninformed of what was occurring, but directly misled. Ladies and gentlemen, that's what classified means. Classified does not nearly mean to keep secrets, that if asked a direct question about something that contained classified elements of information, that you would simply hush up, try to hurriedly turn the other cheek. No. Classified means that if necessary, you will directly attempt to divert, to mislead, to misinform, to steer someone away from the truth. You'll flat out lie in order to protect that secret. That's what classified means. That's what programs like the Tuskegee experiments were considered to have been. And yet people like you and me, people who consider themselves healers, who dedicated their education and their lives, career to healing, they can make such hideous, heinous violations, even of their own oath, of their own ethics, cross paths with their own God. Why? Because they're asked to? By whom? By their government? Your humble host is frustrated, ladies and gentlemen. Frustrated because not only do we have enormous amounts of history available at our fingertips, which in this information age are easily verifiable, you can perform in the course of 1 hour what researchers 50 years ago may have required a month. And yet, so many of us don't do that. You've heard an expression that ignorance of the law presents no excuse for acts committed unlawfully. Well, the same is true of history, ladies and gentlemen. Ignorance of history is no excuse for being burned by it over and over and over again. And we live in an era now where these powers that be, these powers who good men have fought and died for in a struggle against all throughout the course of human history, and where good men are dying today in an effort to expose the truth, we live in an era where you yourself might very well be freight trained by history. And you will not have even known the license of the truck that hit you unless you begin to do the research. I'm not asking you to hold all the information that's been presented by Dr. Stanley Monteith or any of my previous guests or even the information presented by your humble host as fact. No, rather the contrary. If anything, I'd like you to treat all of this as merely a signpost and begin your own path of research. Follow these threads, these names that we share, these events, these dates, these books, these authors, these researchers, and especially these members of the elite, these members of the ugly agenda. Take note. Begin the work. Begin the research. There are too few good men willing to commit their hearts, their minds, and perhaps their own lives to this work. Your help is needed. The call is out. The time is now. Ladies and gentlemen, along these lines of classified information, along these lines of how it is that we're not allowed to simply know the key findings, the important information, the essential operations of various aspects of our government, of our military. No, we're not allowed to know these things in their entirety, in their whole condition. Instead, we're forced to ferret out because of their machinations. We're forced to ferret out the truth by reading between the lines. And at times that entire truth comes crashing into the daylight. Just recently in the news, in the last year, a series of experiments conducted that were somewhat similar to that of the Tuskegee experiments came to light. And our U.S. government, our State Department, Hillary Clinton herself, were forced to make an apology for these things that were done decades ago. And that is the pattern. Ye shall know them by the fruits that they bear, and their fruits are evil. And that is their pattern. Their pattern is to admit nothing until they have full awareness that the lie can no longer be concealed. Just like these so-called leaders who are around us in this day. These so-called leaders, men like this Wiener in New York, who plays every angle of the gambit to try to hide his evil and his misdoings. Someone who, even when it first comes to light and he's forced to make his admission, although he'd been trying to keep it covered and concealed for over a week, when he's finally come to the awareness that he can no longer hide in the darkness with the facts of the matter, then his approach changes. And what is his next tack? Well, yes, I've made mistakes, but I don't see as though it's necessary to resign. I've broken no law. Sir, you've broken no law. You've broken no law. What commitment did you make to your bride? What commitment did you make to your God? What commitment have you made to your constituents? What commitment did you make to uphold the Constitution of the United States? You've broken no law, and so you needn't resign, but yet now you have resigned. And why? Because it's politically expedient for you. The sooner to crawl back under some stone for some time, the sooner the public will forget. And what saddens me, ladies and gentlemen of the listening audience, is that that line of hideous, disgusting logic, unfortunately bears fruit. Why? Because between sports and American Idol and leisure pursuits and shit like Jersey Shore, yeah, Americans all too often do forget fairly quickly. And I implore you, do not forget. Good men for centuries have paid the price of their blood and their lives to create windows of liberty, to create microcosms of freedoms for you. Do not dishonor their sacrifices. Learn, read, build your knowledge base. Now it is more essential than at any point in history. I'm going to conclude by turning my comments back to how we opened our conversation. Our first guest on the Crimson Pill today was Mr. Ali Adams, who was gracious to join us, and we will pick up that conversation on next week's program as we discussed his findings in his research, mathematically based, in an analysis of the Holy Book of Islam, the Quran. We'll continue that discussion next week, but the reason that we began that discussion is because of the potential consequences, the ways that we might be affected. And neither Mr. Adams nor myself is making the claim that this is the end of the world. What we're attempting to offer you are signposts, places to look, places to begin your research. And with Mr. Adams, I want to revisit his website, which is www.helawave.com, HELIWAVE, HelaWave.com, and I implore you to go to that website. He has a white paper, a book, fully. It's fully fair to refer to it as a book. It is called Quran and 2012. You can access it for free on PDF format on his website, where he makes a very thorough and very detailed exposition of the methodology of his work, his approach, the use of prime numbers. And also he shares with us very graciously some of the conclusions that he reaches that extend beyond the mathematics and the text of the Quran proper. Folks, I have to wind the program down for today in short order. But I do wish to close on one final thought regarding Comet Elanine. Try to set the stage for next week's program when we rejoin our conversation with Mr. Ali Adams and talk about this more fully. Ladies and gentlemen, we've all heard about the Mayan prophecy. The time date that we're most familiar with in that sense is December 21st of 2012. But you need to know that we don't use the current calendar system That's the same as what the Mayans calendar is. Just like Mr. Adams shared with us how the Islamic calendar varies from our own, as well as the Judaic calendar varies from our own. Well, in fact, our calendar hasn't been a constant thing through the course of time. Today we operate on what is called the Gregorian calendar, named because it was commissioned by Pope Gregory only a few hundred years ago. And prior to that, the Western world primarily used what was called the Julian calendar, referred to because it was commissioned by Julius Caesar in 45 BC. And at each change in these calendar systems, big adjustments have had to have been made in how time itself is quote-unquote calibrated. And some folks have done quality research in the idea that the Mayan calendar does not end on December 21st, 2012 of our Gregorian calendar. Due to these adjustments that have been made between the Julian and later the Gregorian calendar, it is, in fact, believed by many of these folks who have done considered research that the end of the Mayan calendar is actually October 28th of this fall, 2011. And that is significant because that falls within mere weeks of Comet Elenine's projected perihelion. More alarmingly even, it's within 12 days of its forecasted perigee, which is its closest orbital distance to the center of the Earth. The Mayan calendar, when factored in with the machinations of the Julian and Gregorian calendar and recalibrations thereof, Mayan calendar actually ends within 12 days of Comet Elenine's closest approach to Earth. And I finally end with the notion of Hopi prophecy, the Hopi Indians, the Native Americans, H-O-P-I. Between now and next week, folks, do a little research on Hopi prophecy. And I'll tell you just very quickly what they call their blue star prophecy. And Comet Elenine will indeed appear to be a magnificent, spectacular blue star in the sky with a long element to it that probably would almost appear to be what Emperor Constantine saw in the sky back just before 325 AD that led him, as the story goes, story in quotation marks, led him to find Christ, to find Jesus, to convene the Council of Nicaea, and to found Christianity as it has continued to be known today. Well, that's how Elenine quite likely will appear for us in our night sky in September. Maybe as early as late August, certainly as we approach late September. Elenine will be, in fact, a blue star, and that is sometimes how the Hopi prophecy is referred to as. And part of the Hopi prophecy says, "The fourth world shall end soon, and the fifth world will begin. This the elders everywhere know. The signs over many years have been fulfilled, and so few are left. This is the first sign. We are told of the coming of the white-skinned men, like Pahana, but not living like Pahana, men who took the land that was not theirs, and men who struck their enemies with thunder. This is the second sign. Our lands will see the coming of spinning wheels filled with voices. In his youth, my father saw this prophecy come true with his eyes, the white men bringing their families and wagons across the prairies. This is the third sign. A strange beast, like a buffalo, but with great long horns, will overrun the land in large numbers, these white feathers saw with his eyes. The coming of the white men's cattle." Ladies and gentlemen, for now I'm going to leave you on that, the third sign of the Hopi prophecy. When we come back next week, we'll talk about the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth and last sign of the Hopi prophecy. And we'll talk about how other paths and traditions have also foreseen certain crossings of lines of events in human history that might in fact represent our 11th hour, this window that we are in today. Ladies and gentlemen of the listening audience, your humble host does not believe that we face the end of the world itself in this coming 18 months. Your host fully believes that we face a change in the world as we know it that most of us are unprepared for. And whether the events that cause this change come from the heavens or whether they come from the people who do premeditated evil here on earth, there is a change coming. The question is, will we be prepared for it? Ladies and gentlemen, I'm your host, Antonin Fiore. Thank you so much for joining our broadcast today. We'll see you next week.